The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 17th, 2023. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, Brian Grimm, will be joining us. And then the host or co-host of Hell on Earth, also from that other podcast, Chapo Trap House. Matt Chrisman will be joining us. Meanwhile, the Dominion lawsuit exposes Fox News as massive, despicable charlatans.
And cowards.
Senator John Fetterman checks into a hospital to treat depression in the wake of his stroke recovery. Rick Scott retreats on Social Security and Medicare sunsetting. DeWine finally asks for federal help in Ohio. And another Republican Congress member found to have been lying about his background. Meet Tennessee Republican Andy Ogles, if that's his name. Meanwhile, North Dakota lawmakers, Matt, advance a bill to cap insulin prices at $25 a month.
That's good.
Oh.
Also censoring Trump's library books, but that's good.
Say again?
They're also passed a bill to censor library books, but that's good about the insulin.
Okay. Trump still would lead over DeSantis in a more or less meaningless poll, but perhaps predictive poll. Tesla to recall nearly 400,000 cars with full self-driving systems. Huh. Idaho lawmakers introduce a bill to criminalize those who administer COVID vaccines. Pennsylvania Governor Shapiro seeks to abolish the death penalty in Pennsylvania. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is the close of another week in this era of, well, I don't know what kind of era it is. I wanted to say something
more
dramatic.
Get poetic,
Sam.
It's Friday.
It's Friday. Casual Friday. Emma Vigeland, what? I know what it is. We're in the post-UA cheese era.
Yes, but like not just any cheese. Bradley decided to get me blue cheese. That was what
when I left, it was like at string cheese. I'm like, okay, I think she can handle that. And then I tune in and she's gagging on blue cheese.
You know, when I got into this business, this is the kind of important work that I set out to do.
People are already on the IM asking for clips of your cheese stuff. Maybe we'll do this on Monday.
We'll do it on Monday. Go to ESPN. No, we don't need to relive it.
I'm not going to be here on Monday.
Yeah.
Shoot. Yeah.
Just
so
go to the
folks got to go to ESPN to see this. It's all over the place. I mean, almost literally.
I survived. I really did.
Emma survived. She survived the cheese. But I mean, we're all living in that. In that era. Meanwhile, let's get right into this. I don't know exactly how many days it was after. Was it 13 days maybe after the spill in Ohio? I don't know how many days after DeWine said, I don't think we need that. Everything seems to be fine. Governor DeWine asks the federal government for emergency assistance. And then we saw teams from Health and Human Services and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, EPA was already there, coming to help residents in Palestine, Ohio. Here is DeWine, and this is interesting. There's almost two stories that we're going to watch in this clip. One is that DeWine was not asking for this assistance for the longest period of time. And I'm unclear why that might be the case. Maybe Ryan Grimm will have a theory on that. But the other thing that's going on here is stuff started leaking from the Dominion lawsuit, or not really even leaking. It was, some of it was released. A lot of it's redacted in discovery. And I think there are people at Fox News who are feeling a little uncomfortable today. And maybe, like, you know, maybe spending a little more time on trying to be a little bit truthful today, just as some type of, like, I don't know, penance. But here is Fox and Friends.
On the water is good, the air is good, but we understand people have concerns.
Well, Governor, so, why, if the air is good and the water is good, why are residents saying, here's some of the quotes, I don't see birds in my property anymore. The rivers have dead fish in them and worms. My throat has been burning, a horrible cough, sneezing, congestion, eyes burning. I mean, clearly they're experiencing this. So if the air is clean and the water is clean, how do you explain that?
Look, we've this is why we're going to bring in the best experts in the country.
What are you waiting for? It's already been 2 weeks. It's already been 2 weeks.
We already had, had our director of health, Dr. Vanderhoff, who has been in the community talking with people. We've told people, you know, you need to go to see your individual doctor. But we also know there are people who may not have an individual doctor. We know there are people who may not have insurance. Mm-hmm. And that's why setting up this clinic to assure people and to talk to people one-on-one, have them come in and do an assessment. Right. And again, the docs who will be there will have direct access to the best people in the country who understand toxicity.
Okay, which we do not. So we have to rely on the experts. But Governor,
why not do your own research? You know, the amazing thing about this, too, is that what is interesting about this is that there is at least some acknowledgement from someone on the right that DeWine was standing in the way of federal involvement in this. Yeah. And, you know, I think overall there is clearly, I mean, I wouldn't call it a full-on cover-up, but there's clearly an effort from the beginning to minimize all of this. And that's, you know, I think there may be some people who are being too expansive in terms of, like, the dangers here. I mean, it's enough to say that, like, 5,000 people have been poisoned in some fashion. That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I think being precautious is maybe called for in a situation like this.
Well, and also their whole ideology or their attempts to downplay this and let Norfolk Southern kind of handle it from here and do their own assessment. I mean, they canceled last minute on East Palestine residents who had organized this town hall, just essentially trying to get answers. And they said, you know, we were fearful of the growing amount of physical threats on Norfolk Southern employees because of, you know, the toxic climate, because they're the true victims here, right? Like,
toxic climate.
Exactly. But the lack of adequate response, I think, I mean, it's creating pressure on DeWine, as it should, because Norfolk Southern just wants us to go away, obviously.
I mean, they were slow in talking about how many tankers carried this stuff. Mm-hmm. They were it was when DeWine was giving a press conference that they arrested the guy doing a national news segment on it. And this is from top to bottom. There's been an attempt to keep this essentially quiet, if you will. Here is J.D. Vance, who we first saw talking about this 10 days after the fact, when he released a statement that in some way pretended like the federal government could come in and FEMA could come in without a request from the governor, never mentions the governor's name. Here he is talking to reporters on Wednesday, finally getting engaged in this. This is, you know, his version of Ted Cruz going to, where was it? Cancun.
And did Sherrod Brown say, you know, he called on the governor now
yesterday?
To,
Sherrod Brown released the official, like, call on the governor to, you know.
So that's some pressure on this jabroni, too.
Here's J.D. Vance.
Would you like the EPA administrator to drink the tap water?
You know, it reminds me of that scene in Erin Brockovich where she puts the water in front of them and says, if you think it's clean, we brought this water from, you know, the community that was affected. Look, I think that if the EPA administrator wants to stand here and tell people that the tap water is safe, by all means, they should be willing to drink it.
I'm not sure the point he's trying to make there, you know, in that instance.
Except to deflect responsibility and keep saying the EPA Biden, EPA Biden.
And,
it's a lie. Because...
And make sure that there's no connection between, like, sort of like, we need federal roles involvement in these things, or we don't have the ability to clean this water. I mean,
you know, speaking of Erin Brockovich, yesterday, about 24 hours ago, it's day 13 and Mike DeWine finally called Biden back just in time for the weekend. So that's what Erin Brockovich was actually saying. You can, you know, reference her movie and
yeah.
like, get points for that, but, or we could actually just say what she's saying.
Now, J.D. Vance just is interested in the Julia Roberts version, right? Not the reality.
All right. We're going to take a break in a moment. Let's speak with Ryan Grimm. First, a couple of words from our sponsors today. It's Friday. You know what that means? SunsetLakeCBD.com. Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST and you will get 20% off. You will get 20% off all their tinctures. They've got ones with melatonin. They've got ones that are flavored. They've got it all different concentrations. They have three different flavors. Tinctures are my go-to with melatonin these days, unless I'm taking one of their gummies with melatonin. But they also have gummies with just CBD. They also have gummies with CBD and THC, which I also actually am quite enjoying quite a bit these days. It's just a trace. It's so little THC that it's legal. But for folks, you know, who don't spend as much time with that product as other people. I'm not pointing fingers, Matt. It's actually quite fun. But they also have CBD fudge. They have CBD coffee. They have smokables. They have kief. All great products, all third-party tested. They use integrated pest management. That means no pesticides. They also use integrated farming, agricultural processes, so that they protect their the soil. They're great business practices, $20 minimum wage, mostly employee-owned company. They are also movement partners. They have spent thousands upon thousands of dollars supporting things like strike funds and food pantries and immigration resettlement and Innocence Project and Give Directly. I mean, just a great all-around company, a great all-around product. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, longtime fans of the show, and you get 20% off. It's a great deal. Also makes for great gifts. Also, today's program sponsored by ZBiotics. What is ZBiotics? It is a pre-alcohol probiotic that is genetically engineered. You drink like a little bottle like this before you have any alcohol. One drink, multiple drinks, doesn't matter. You get a little bit, you know, rest that night, obviously, and drink responsibly. The next morning, there is none of that crappy feeling that you get the next morning after drinking alcohol. So if you want to go out and, I don't know, work out, or you want to do work or do a podcast or whatever it is, and make sure you're in top form, ZBiotics is the way. And the way it works, I was always under the impression that, you know, that feeling crappy from drinking the day after was a function of dehydration. That's a little part of it. But the big thing is that alcohol creates a byproduct in your gut that ends up making you feel crappy. And drinking this probiotic beforehand basically means that tomorrow is going to be a productive or fun or relaxing day. I've used it on the cruise that I went on. I used it last weekend. Went down to see, it was almost like a reunion type of situation on the Jersey Shore. Bunch of people I hadn't seen in a long time, but had to get up early the next morning. And I was in great shape. You can get 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic by clicking the link in the description and using our code MAJORITY at checkout. Go to ZBiotics, ZBiotics, ZBiotics.com/majority. We will put the code in our YouTube and podcast description. Check it out. 15% off your first order of ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic by clicking on that link. Also, our final sponsor for the day, Aura. What does Aura do? Well, it basically protects all sorts of your online assets and just yourself, I guess, from online things, or your kids at the very least. I'm very nervous about my identity being stolen all the time just because it's a huge, huge pain in the butt. And so, you know, I lock my credit cards, but sometimes I have to unlock, or your credit reports, but sometimes you have to unlock them. This is a great backup and also maybe first line of defense. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers. They scan the dark web, and not the intellectual dark web, but they scan the actual dark web to see if your passwords or emails have been compromised, or your social security number for that matter. It alerts you if it finds anything. In fact, when you put your email in, when you first sign up for Aura, you're going to get 2 weeks free. But when you do that, they'll kick back and say where your passwords and email has been compromised on different websites. Also, they send automatic takedown notices to those websites that post all of your public information. That means less robocalls, less junk mail, and also maintains operational security, as it were. They give you real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, so no one's going to go out and take a fake loan in your name or open up a credit card in your name and go out and spend all your money. They have a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online, keeps your browsing history and personal information safe and encrypted. They protect your devices from viruses and malware and spyware, all that junk. And they let you manage what your kids do on their devices. So you can make sure they do focus time instead of like YouTube. You can set screen time limits. You can restrict specific apps, et cetera, et cetera. They have a password manager that allows you to store and access your online passwords. And the bottom line is you may have an app that does one of these things. Well, you don't need to go out and get seven, because you can let Aura do the hard work of keeping you safe online with all those features. And if you sign up right now, Aura will give you 2 week free trial with my link. When you put that, when you put your email and password, your email in there, you're going to be shocked to find out how much of your information is exposed online. Go to aura.com/majority. That's aura.com/majority. Start your free trial. As always, links are in the podcast and YouTube description and on the website. And a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can get the free half free of commercials by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. And as always, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code Majority, you get 10% off. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Ryan Grimm. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us, the Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, the host. What do you, it's a cross points?
Counterpoints.
Counterpoints. You had to think about it.
Yeah, I did. The original show that Crystal and Sagar do was called Breaking Points.
Breaking Points.
So we're kind of on brand and off brand with the counterpoints.
Counterpoints. And of course, you've got a bad news newsletter as well.
It's on Substack. That's right. Yeah. And my podcast. Got to listen to the podcast, Deconstructed.
Oh, Deconstructed. Very busy man, Ryan.
Yeah, we're going to have a Villages themed podcast tomorrow. That'll be
out. Well, that piece was insane. Yeah. Maybe we'll get into that.
Coming after a big piece. Folks should check that out. That's a great sort of like long weekend read, the insanity going on down there. But we've got a lot of insanity going on up a little bit more north of Florida, Ryan. Let's go through. There's a couple things I want to talk about. Let's start first with I think the one of the biggest stories of the week has been this train derailment, which is actually – the train derailment itself, 14 days old at this point. I think it was Friday. I think it was 2 weeks ago today, maybe, that the derailment happened. And just yesterday, DeWine calls in the federal government. What's fascinating about this story to me is that there's like four or five different stories that come off of this, particularly in the wake of I guess the broader knowledge that people had about the way these freight companies were operating because of the near strike that took place last fall. What's your sense of the way this is going?
For a long time, the press wasn't covering it at all. And now you're starting to see politicians complaining that the press is focusing too much on it, which I think is actually kind of the power of the independent media. I think that we underestimate the reach of the mainstream media and the lack of reach of independent media. I think both left and right independent media were covering this pretty relentlessly from the beginning. And as a result, it penetrated the public consciousness. And it did so largely without the mainstream media covering it with much significance in the early stages. So I think it's actually a window into the way that people are getting news now, because it's filtering to politicians that like, oh wait, people are really angry about this and are really following this pretty closely. And they're not following it very closely because CNN or Fox News was on it. And the mainstream media, I think, shied away from it because it's not partisan and it's not, and there's no easy way to like, you know, use it as a club to beat your partisan enemies with. Like it's, there's no kind of solution sitting on the table that you can say like we're for this and they're against this or whatever, because it's so fundamental to the kind of structure of the economy and of our politics that to actually address it would require kind of a radical analysis of what went wrong. And not Fox, CNN, MSNBC, none of them want to do that. You know, they just want to play kind of partisan.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you got the balloon. Yeah, the balloon. No, you're right. The balloon is much more interesting.
At the same time,
yes,
right? And
right.
Honestly, that's what dominated coverage at that point.
Yes.
And I think that contrast between what independent media was focused on versus what cable news in particular was focused on, that was one of the more stark examples that I've seen in a long period of time.
But isn't it also too like the lack of local media coverage like that would, you know, that would, I mean, they were covering it, certainly. But it seemed, you know, to some extent from a distance, and it was images. And I guess maybe that's why, independent media was able to pick it up in the way that it did. But it also feels to me like I'm unclear, like that it has been covered on the right. And I'm unclear like what their angle has been. I mean, you know, because for when we first saw it, I remember I was headlining it on 2 weeks ago today, I think, because we had spent a lot of time engaging in the near strike and that particular dynamic of railway workers looking for some ability to take sick leave, which they couldn't because of a function of the freight company's desire to have lean and, you know, mean transport, which also meant that they had longer trains, which meant that you had situations like this. And then the idea, you know, I think Lever News did a great job in sort of like digging into the stuff about the breaks and whatnot. And I'm unclear like what the angle was for the right and when they were pushing this, other than I guess maybe it was a way for them to attack Buttigieg, which, you know, he deserved it, frankly. Yes. It's and this brings up the other story is like, and this came up the other day, what is going on with the Department of Transportation? I mean, I don't, they just the other day, there was a new chief of staff inserted there, or someone who came over, I think it was from the FTC, as a way to maybe like there's an awareness in the administration that there's a failure coming from them, you know, following the airline stuff. What's happening with that?
Yeah, that's Jen Howard, who you may know. You know, she's she's known as kind of a very pugnacious and an aggressive kind of reformer. And she was Lina Khan's chief of staff. That they moved her from FTC over to the Department of Transportation, and it was seen as a sign of like, all right, she's going to come over there and crack some knuckles. Like that's not somebody you send in there if you're trying to play nice with industry. People can go read the Politico profile of her, which is supposed to read like a hit piece, but you come away from it, you're like, this person sounds great. Like, this is the type of regulator we need in dealing with these industries, not the kind of person who is going to leave the FTC and then immediately go work for a big law firm that represents big tech, or is going to leave the Department of Transportation and go work as a lobbyist for the railroads or the airlines, which is the kind of traditional career path, and is the reason that she has so many enemies kind of inside. But you're right that Buttigieg makes it too easy for the right, because the right doesn't have a second move. Like, they're correct in saying Pete Buttigieg has some responsibility here. Pete Buttigieg is failing in his job. Where they would have problems if Pete Buttigieg came back and said, okay, cool, so then let's make these rules tougher. Let's start fining the railroads. Let's write harder rules and actually enforce them. Let's give our enforcement mechanisms some teeth. You're right. We're falling down at the job. Let's do a better job. And then you'd have the right being like, whoa, 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 not like that.
Well, they don't have
a solution.
Is that going
to
happen?
That dynamic, we should say, also, yeah, happens across the board with a bunch of issues. There is no second step to this. Right. And, but Emma brings up the point, like, it also is sort of like there's a certain amount of like bluff calling that's not happening. And right. and that's a little bit problematic.
Right, because they know he is probably going to call the bluff. Like, Buttigieg is not going to say, okay, yeah, let's do some tough enforcement on these bosses, which I frankly don't understand from a political perspective. I understand that he's a McKinsey guy, that where his allegiances are, that he wants to run for president and he wants to be in good with the people that could fund a presidential campaign. But you don't have a viable presidential campaign to fund if you are coming off of the most disastrous tenure of a transportation secretary since like the 19th century. If there even was a transportation department back then. Like,
the amazing thing is that I can't name, I mean, I probably could if I really thought about it or I would remember, but this is not like a high profile job.
Right.
And the idea that you would come out of this with a net negative, that's a hard thing to do, it seems like. And there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, you could sit down and calculate like, okay, I'm not going to get any campaign donations from the transportation industry. Let's just say, I mean, airlines but I might get some support from unions in both those things, pretty big union, representation, certainly high profile. Mm-hmm. It does seem like both a problem with, like, because we were speculating the other day that wonder if like a place like Northwick, their whole streamlining efficiency program is probably advised by someone like a McKinsey consultant, if not a McKinsey consultant. Yeah. And so he's just steeped in this ideology, but it means that he also can't overcome it, even in his own self-interest, his own political self-interest.
Right. And if you talk to his defenders, they'll say that a lot of this, that he's been dealt a terrible hand. He got, you know, that what are the chances that the airline's computer crashes while he's transportation secretary? Oh, the supply chain's breaking down is just brutal. And it's the pandemic's fault. It's not his fault. What are the chances that you'd have this Southwest debacle? Like, all of these things are landing on him. But at the same time, those are also opportunities.
Huge opportunities.
Like, exactly. Like, the only one I remember is LaHood, because he was a Republican who used to say funny things.
Right, LaHood.
Obama appointed a Republican. That's how little presidents care about this, because they're willing to, they're like, we know, he was like, I want a Republican in my cabinet. Where's the, like, least dangerous place I can put a Republican? Oh, put that LaHood guy over at transportation. And so it is a backwater, and it's, which is going to be a handicap to using it as a presidential springboard, unless all of a sudden you get all these crises, and then you can use those crises as opportunities to go banging heads.
That's the amazing thing about
this. You're so mad. Well, guess what? I banged the heads together of all of these airline CEOs, or I'm yelling at these railroads, or I'm enforcing this. And instead, nothing.
Nothing. Except for, I mean, the only time we see him is to go on, really to defend himself on Fox News, but not even necessarily about particular issues. Right. Like every clip I've ever seen him.
Just owning the right on.
Yeah. He's been eloquent in those. Well, eloquent may be a strong word, but he's been adept at that. But it really has been completely substance free. And there, like you say, there are three major crises that he could have been like a hero in and said, like, you know, we're going to do this in terms of like our supply lines. And we're going to, I'm going to refer to the DOJ about what's happening with all these big ships that are coming in, and we need to have smaller ships and more competition. I'm going to do this with the airlines. I'm going to do this with the rail freight in nothing. And it's really it's fascinating. And just the idea that they sent over this chief of staff means that somebody in the White House gets the fact that that he's either unwilling or inept at doing any of this stuff.
Right, because Buttigieg is not the kind of person who's going to request a Jen Howard.
No, he wouldn't want it. Like,
now, Lina Khan wants a Jen Howard, because she and Rohit Chopra, who Jen had worked for before, who's now the CFPB chair, like, those types of people want, you know, aides like that, who are going to be tough and are going to stand up to industry. But somebody like Buttigieg has to have that foisted on him. So yeah, he could have come out of this a hero, because I think people would love it if he showed competence. Like, the McKinsey thing doesn't have to be a handicap. The McKinsey thing could be like, look, I'm really good at getting stuff done. And so yeah, you might not like that I'm a kind of Poindexter like consultant type, but look at the way that I put those skills to work in solving the supply chain crisis, in solving this airline debacle. In cracking down on the greedy railroads. Like, look at how I use those skills. But if you're just a McKinsey guy who's kind of extracting money from the system while leaving the system not working, then how is that your launching pad to the White House?
It's bizarre to me. And it's also just, I mean, it has to be ideological, as we said here, right? He just, I think, is ideologically a consultant through and through, where the lean labor model, the elongation of the trains, that's something he's just much more sympathetic to. And what's shocking is that he's not, and I think it's hurting Biden to a degree, maybe it might in the end, because the response hasn't been as forceful as I think would be good politically. He's not even saying, let's reinstate that Obama era breaking rule that the Lever had been done such a great job reporting on. Like, that's not even going to hurt their pocketbooks at all, really, based on the Lever's reporting. And that would be a moment where you could actually act, right? And look like you're doing something while still maintaining your commitment to that ideology. And that's what's just show he's also bad at politics is really the lesson I'm learning from this.
His nickname as mayor was Pothole Pete. Like he didn't do the basic things as mayor that, you know, a mayor is expected to do, which is, you know, number one, fix the potholes. Because that's the number one thing that people get upset at a mayor for.
To be clear, his nickname was Pothole Pete because he didn't fill the potholes.
Pete,
you know, like a sewer socialist, right? That would be good if he was out there, you know,
filling the potholes.
Yes. Yes.
No, the town was pockmarked with potholes. And so he was getting knocked. Like the problem with the city was too many potholes. And I remember when they named him transportation secretary, I was thinking, did they do a background check and know that his nickname was Pothole Pete for not fixing potholes?
Well, they could have made the same mistake that I made, which is Pothole Pete. This is a guy who really cares about potholes.
He fixes potholes. There was a
big nickname
bus
should have been Pockmark.
He screwed up the bus routes.
Yeah, it should have been Pockmark Pete, because then that would have been more clear. That there were too many potholes.
This is actually...
That does not make it more clear at all, Sam.
At least you ask about it. I mean, if he had just said Pothole Pete, I would have just walked away assuming, like, dude really cared about potholes.
Yeah, they call me Pothole Pete. I'm gonna whip this into shape. But yeah, there was also some bus scandal, as I remember. Like, he screwed up the bus. So, like, there are, like, two things. Roads and buses in South Bend that he was responsible for as mayor and, like, botched them both. And they're like, hey, do you want to be transportation secretary?
Yeah, well, he was just, you know, dining with the cops and stuff like that instead.
It's an incredible story, and there would have been a real opportunity for, you know, the administration to be seen as competent to sort of, like, that sector of the population that wants to feel like government is just doing something as opposed to nothing, and also build their credentials on, you know, with the base of the party to see that, like, we're not afraid to go over corporate interests. We're not afraid to take on, you know, CEOs who are just doing buybacks instead of investing in the safety of the American public. We can also strengthen our hand with labor by saying, like, you know what, we're going to do the federal contracts, and you guys are going to have to provide paid sick leave and not demerits for sick leave. And that's going to have a knock-on effect of making them hire more people, and it'll make it more worthwhile to have shorter trains. I mean, they just had another derailment in Detroit. I don't know. I mean, I think the best thing about this story is it's drawing attention to a problem that has been existing that hasn't gotten much attention, really. But I think it's just because of the nature of, like, you know, cell phones and social media and these images, which are so disturbing in many respects. But let's move on to another big story that is out there that is still in the wake of the State of the Union. I don't think we've spoken to you since the State of the Union. One of the things I thought was amazing to watch in that State of the Union was when Biden basically got the Republicans to pledge, even though I think it was because Trump had told them, you're not messing with Social Security and Medicare on this debt ceiling thing. Biden ended up getting the credit, and it's in the news for 2 weeks. You know, it locks in the Democrats, not just the Republicans, to this. Mm-hmm. And yesterday, Rick Scott had to disavow his own plan. It got so bad. Yes. It's amazing to me.
Truly remarkable, because you've got all of these political scientists who like to do their, like, weird kind of political science analysis to show you that speeches actually don't matter, which maybe they're right. You know, maybe there's something to that. Like, they don't move public opinion. They don't do anything when it comes to legislation, etc. This is the first time that you can see a speech, like, matter in the negotiations.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like changing the status and the course of the negotiations. Like, now what debt ceiling fight are they going to have? Like, they're not slashing the Pentagon. Like, is that the fight they want to have? Okay, fine.
The Republicans in the Senate came out the other day, at least it was reported that they're not going for that.
No, they're not doing that. So, Bureau of Land Management, You're going to like...
They're also messing around back with there. Work requirements for SNAP, which is, you know, just that's just autopilot for the Republican Party.
Right. You're gonna threaten a global financial crisis over work requirements for SNAP. Like,
yeah.
You now look ridiculous. Because so they've completely hamstrung themselves in these negotiations, and to get to allow Biden to get the credit for that is quite remarkable. And you know, if they hadn't been hooting and hollering about it,
it would have never come up. Yeah. No,
I mean he'd have said, "We're not cutting Medicare and Social Security, and I'm going to veto your stuff if you try," and then you just move on, and it wouldn't have been a thing because every Democratic president has said that forever, and even the ones who are willing to cut Social Security and Medicare.
Right.
But yeah, they had to hoot and holler and make a scene, and now they have blown it for themselves for a
while.
They
also, there was also that part where he turned back to McCarthy and said, you know, "Will you show me your plan?" And McCarthy said, "Okay." And of course, like, that was what McCarthy's whole strategy was, to not present a plan, maybe because they can't come up with one. And they certainly had less stuff to put in that plan beforehand. I mean, has anybody talked about the idea that, okay, I mean, and I think Biden did a good job over the past 2 weeks of just like, "I'm going to keep doing this," because they're jamming them up. What about now, like, coming back with like expanding Social Security or you know, dealing with the cap?
Yeah. I mean,
you've crossed the 50-yard line, right? Why not take it down the downfield?
What they're definitely realizing is that this is a great wedge issue on the Republican side, because as they have expanded the share of the working class vote, they're at about 50% now of the working class votes Republican. They're all old, like, you know, their electorate is super old, and so as a result, there is very strong support for protecting Social Security, and not protecting it in the way that Republicans of like Paul Ryan talk about protecting and strengthening it, by which they mean making it smaller,
right?
Cutting it. So you say, hey, if we give $5 a month to everybody, then it's the strongest program ever, because that'll never go bankrupt. So, and the Republican base now is like, no, we want the benefits we have, and we want the benefits we have to keep going up. And so there is this fundamental divide between them and the Chamber of Commerce Republicans. And yeah, I think hitting it with the payroll tax thing is smart. Like, and Bernie does it at 250. Like, he says he'll lift the cap for everybody making above 250.
Does the donut hole, essentially.
Right. So that gives you a little, so people in the middle are like, all right, I'm fine. Whereas I think Schumer, usually he's in like 400 range. Like, they have different ideas of what counts as wealthy. Whereas Schumer would be like, everybody over 400 pay, but whatever, like, put that to Republicans. Say, all right, you actually want to make this program solvent. There's two ways to do it. Well, there's three. You could debt finance it, but they're not going to do that. You can either bring in more money, or you can cut benefits. And if you're not willing to bring in more money, then you're saying that you need to cut benefits, or you need to stop talking about it.
The other interesting thing is that it also creates a wedge issue. Like, it is, in some ways, the social insurance policy as a political matter is functioning as a political insurance policy, because DeSantis has been really sort of like oddly quiet about this, because I think he doesn't want to be seen as like sort of following Trump's lead, and he needs the Republican establishment, and he doesn't want to sort of like, that's the Holy Grail. I mean, that's literally been their 90-year, if there's been a core, I think, like, like, piece of being a Republican during that time, regardless of what happened, like, with civil rights and all of this, you know, there's been one tentpole, as it were, cut Social Security. It's, you know, socialism, starting in 1936, I think, in their platform. And so DeSantis is screwed on this, because it's going to be hard for him to come out and say, I've changed my mind from where I was 5 years ago when I wanted to privatize it.
Right. And also, I think he's smart enough to realize that the public doesn't like it when Republicans are talking about Social Security.
Right.
Like, they're really, there really isn't any, no matter what they're saying, it all just seems like code words for we want to cut your Social Security, unless it's Trump talking about it. And when people hear Trump talk about it, where he's like, I'm not cutting Social Security like these other idiot Republicans want to do. People are like, cool. That's where I am too. Like, he's the only one that has any credibility on that. DeSantis, because immediately he would start saying that we need to strengthen the program and we're gonna protect benefits for existing retirees and people who are going to get it soon. Like, that's the way Republicans talk about it. And that doesn't assure anybody. Nobody right. feels better hearing that only 250 million people are going to see cuts, not the current people getting it. Because the current people getting it don't necessarily believe that. They think once you start cutting it for other people, why am I then sacred? And then everybody else is like, wait a minute, don't cut it. So yeah, so he's probably right that it's just not helpful for them to be talking about Social Security, no matter what they say.
Let's also, there was another piece this week that that didn't get much attention, and it outlined that the administration was starting to basically pressure. And there's been, you know, some talk as to whether, you know, support from the American public and Europe has been waning for the, you know, for the Ukraine, for Ukraine in fighting this invasion by Russia. I'm not quite as convinced about that, but there may be some. But there was a report that the U.S. is starting to say, like, we're going to give you a big push in terms of weaponry, but you need to, like, prioritize what real estate you want to take back, because there seems to be a bit of a push that, like, once you get into spring, we need to start talking about negotiations. And, you know, one of the obvious things about the need to do that now from the perspective of, like, say, the Biden administration is Donald Trump could be president in 18 months or, you know, two years, basically, from, 23 months. And his first act could be like, no more Ukraine stuff. Like, we're gonna, and that would be a bad situation to be in. And it seems like Putin is incredibly committed to this. And another 2 years, he could, if he thought that there was a chance for a Trump, or maybe getting assurances from a different Republican, that he could hang on. What's your sense of that in Washington? What's going on with that? And it sort of also puts to lie the notion that this is a, you know, I have no doubt that there's a lot of people in the U.S. foreign policy establishment are like, a weakened Russia is a good thing, and showing that they cannot be this aggressive is a good thing. And if it destabilizes Putin in some way, that's a good thing too. But it doesn't sound like if it was a proxy war, you wouldn't have that sort of perspective.
Well, I think a lot of people in the DC blob, the foreign policy community, would, you know, think it's, they might not say it out loud, but they would kind of be okay, just like Putin would, with a simmering kind of low grade conflict just going on forever. Like, from their perspective, that drains, you know, Russian strength. It also kills a lot of people. Right. It causes all sorts of problems globally when it comes to energy and food prices. But, you know, we're willing, you know, we've been willing to have a low grade conflict in Syria for the last 10 years. You know, we're still occupying, like, you know, we're still helping to occupy a third of that country or something. You know, we showed we were fine to let Afghanistan and Iraq fester indefinitely. So you could see a scenario where that plays out, and it looked, they're practically almost out of time, because, and what I mean is out of time to, like, get to a negotiated end, because, like you said, by this fall, like, we're in serious kind of presidential times.
Yep.
Like, that's we're almost there now. And so if we haven't reached the end of the war, then, like you said, Putin has every incentive at that point to just hold out. and just lock down. In Washington, you're finally starting to hear people say that, well, we don't really mean that Ukraine has total sovereignty over everything that they, over every decision here. And you saw that with this reporting that the CIA or the U.S. intelligence assessment, that they don't have the capacity to take Crimea. Like that was the moment where Ukraine was really starting to feel its oats, when they were like, we're going to get every Russian boot off of our territory. And also Crimea is our territory. We're going to retake Crimea. Like that was kind of the height of Ukrainian confidence. And for the most part, you heard kind of nothing from American policymakers on that. Not yes, you're right, but not no, we're not going to do that. But behind the scenes, they're all like, no, like we don't, like we didn't in 2014 want to fund a war to kind of retake Crimea, and we're not going to, we can't do that now. And also, we don't necessarily have the capacity to do it. Mm-hmm. Like our manufacturing base is probably can't produce enough weapons that fast to enable or empower something like that. Like, I think people kind of overestimate the amount of explosives and weapons that the world is capable of creating, given these two countries like going at each other with this ferocity for so long.
Well, I guess it remains to be seen, but it is. I mean, hopefully there'll be some type of cessation. I mean, is there any sense of like what folks in Ukraine want in terms of this? Like what is the tolerance for being at war if it means retaking Crimea or parts of the Donbas?
The sense seems to be that as long as the economic aid coupled with the weapons transfers continue, that the Ukrainian public is willing to fight this endlessly until they have exhausted every possible option. But it's more on the kind of allied side, the EU and the US, which are not able to just kind of physically not able to keep that up indefinitely.
All right, let's talk about the last big story of the week. This is the Dominion lawsuit, the discovery that came out. I don't know if you've read I have yet to read the entire sort of like document that has been produced, a lot of which is redacted, I guess. Mm. And God knows what was redacted in there, because the stuff that wasn't redacted is pretty damning Fox News. Now, supposedly, like I've read, they have like something like $3 billion cash on hand, and Dominion's only looking for 1.6. So, I mean, they could, it's not going to, unfortunately, it won't bankrupt Fox. And I don't know if there's any way to sort of like bankrupt them, to show how morally bankrupt they are. But some of these quotes are absolutely nuts in this. I mean, absolutely nuts. Tucker Carlson, I don't know how that guy, honestly, like, I don't know how in the world he, like, looks in the mirror or just walks through the world and doesn't feel like, my God, I'm a despicable person.
The whole thing is the stuff of just defamation nightmares. Like, I don't know how much time you have to spend with kind of defamation lawyers in the work that you do, but at The Intercept, we have a defamation attorney on staff, and anything that is rubs up against the potential legal risk is going to run through that. And so I feel like I deserve like a law degree in defamation at this point, for all of the hoops I've had to go through around this stuff. And it matters what you say internally. We're reminded of that, because it could get, it could come out in discovery. Like if your internal communications suggest that you're not taking your journalistic duty seriously, that can hurt you in court. If there is some indication that you had real reason to believe or a real opportunity to discover that what you're saying wasn't true, and you either didn't take that opportunity or you published the opposite anyway, you are screwed.
And to be clear,
and to see this, like, wow.
And there's there's standards on both ends. There's standards as to who you're talking about, because it right. will change the dynamic. If they're a public figure, your standards are in terms of like your due diligence is actually lower.
Right.
If they're a public figure. And then, you know, there's a gradation of that. Like, is Dominion a public figure because they kept talking about them? Right. The executives? Like, is it, you know, and so
there's an answer to that question. No.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Right. And, you don't get to produce a public figure and then use a public figure defense. Yeah.
And then there's a question of malice. And the malice is not necessarily like, how much do you hate this person?
Right.
As much as, how much are you aware of what you're saying is not true?
Right.
And that's the problem with their internal communications, because if they said nothing, the presumption is it's true because we talk, but they're all over the place in their text
I mean, the audience might not have read it yet. Right. So like some of the texts are just incredibly damning. I mean, there's the fun stuff, right? Like Tucker Carlson calling Trump a demonic force. But the other stuff where, I mean, that group chat with Hannity and Ingram, where they're mocking Sidney Powell and the election claims, right, Sam?
And then Giuliani.
And then at the same time, I mean, this is what makes Tucker just one of the worst people in America. He's saying, texting Hannity and Ingram, get this Fox reporter fired immediately for suggesting that the Dominion lost, the election lies had no merit because the stock price for the company is going down.
Here's the quote. Let me read this because this is amazing. I mean, I knew he was sort of despicable, but I didn't realize I sort of did. It is Carlson was pointing to a tweet in which a Fox reporter, Jackie Heinrich, fact check a tweet from Mr. Trump referring to Fox broadcasts and said there was no evidence of voter fraud from Dominion. Quote, please get her fired. You can hear him saying that almost. Mr. Carlson said, he added, quote, it needs to stop immediately, like tonight. It's measurably hurting the company. And here's the real, like, it's not like there's a question of integrity here or our audience trusts us or whatever. The stock price is down. Not a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I said, absolute defamation nightmare scenario. because the thing that a plaintiff is always trying to prove is that you either knew what you were saying was wrong or you failed to take the proper steps to find out whether or not it was true. And that's where malice comes
in. The obvious steps.
Right. And like you said, malice, people misunderstand malice. People think that malice means you really don't like whoever that you're writing about. It is completely legal to hate your subject with malice. You can hate them all. Like, you can wake up and go to bed despising the person that you're writing about. But I often do.
And that's
your First Amendment right. But what you can't do is say something untrue that you know to be untrue, especially if they're not a public figure. And especially if you had an opportunity to find out if it's untrue. Now, so based on these texts, they knew what they were saying was untrue and they said it anyway. And that $1.6 billion seems like a cheap way out of this for them to me.
Totally. And Carlson took it even a step further, because it wasn't like, he's talking about like, we're an entertainment entity and we're putting out, you know, it's like, we're known for our superhero movies and she's out there putting out like, rom-coms or, you know, and we need to get rid of that. That stock price thing is just, holy crap.
Right. And meanwhile, Dominion was getting destroyed. Like, they're actually getting destroyed by this. Like, what state is going to hire Dominion? And
right.
So their claim, like, because that's the other thing you have to prove
is damages.
And oftentimes you will have situations where the person can prove that the reporter or the journalist or the commentator said something true, said something they knew to be untrue. But then you can't actually find damages, because you'll argue, like, look, you're still fine. Like, you're still employed. You're still getting gigs. You're still a movie star, you know, whatever right. it is. There are actual real obvious damages that are 100% linked to what Fox was saying about them. So,
and I would imagine they'd be able to throw in like some personal claims too, because they, some of the executives were harassed. And
can you imagine, like, if we get harassment, like, imagine what these folks were getting from the January 6th types who were convinced that Dominion, under the direction of Hugo Chavez, you know, had subverted American democracy.
Hugo Chavez
part is my favorite.
Yeah, yeah, but his ghost in the machine.
I wonder if this will have. I mean, they'll pay out the money at one point. I mean, maybe they'll settle, or maybe they won't. I don't know. I wonder if even Dominion at this point would be like, we're not settling. We're going. You know, we're going, because
I'd love it.
You know, there's no cap on this necessarily. Right. Like, a jury could just say, like, you asked for $1.6 billion, but gotta say, they're a news organization. We sort of feel like there should be some punitive aspects to this to change their behavior in the future. Because in the future, let's be clear, the only thing they're going to do is, we don't have text messages anymore. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about this messages. Stuff. Yeah. Yeah, we don't do that anymore. And that's the only thing that will happen there. And so this is, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how that works. And it's also interesting to see that, like, they were afraid of networks that are virtually dead now taking them over with their audience. Their audience is not going to care, right? I mean, like, can we all agree that, like, there's not going to be a single Fox viewer who's going to go, like, I'm not watching this anymore.
Right.
No. I mean, yeah, I'm sure there's some. But, yes, like, they're doing fine. And like you said, the people that they thought were going to be their serious competition on the far right are just falling apart.
I couldn't be happier with all of it that's happening. And I hope that, honestly, if Fox was to go bankrupt, I don't know that I could contain my joy over it.
Well, there was that great quote from somebody, I think it was New Zealand, they're like, you're the only country in, like, the Anglo world that has avoided this, like, far-right, like, Nazi-like populism from surging. Like, what's going on there that's different? And they were like, we don't have Murdoch. Like, the link between our political realignment and a Murdoch-funded news operation is, like, one-to-one.
Yep.
Elon Musk's buddy, you know, chilling in that suite at the Super Bowl.
There you go.
But he's nonpartisan.
Yeah.
Ryan Grimm.
Trust the news.
Yeah.
Ryan Grimm, I understand you got a big story coming out. We will keep our eyes open for that. Appreciate your coming on today, folks. We'll link to your story of that. I didn't even know that place existed, to be honest with you. The Village? I had no idea.
Oh man. I guess it's more of a Pennsylvania, Ohio, Wisconsin kind of retiree destination than New York City.
I was saying to Matt and Bradley before the show, it's honestly ripe for, like, a reality show. That insular community thing, that's perfect.
Let's get Danny McBride on that.
I know, yeah.
Real retirees of the Villages.
Yes. I need to pitch that.
I would
Ryan Grimm, always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
See you later.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Matt Chrisman, we'll get Matt's take on some of that Fox stuff too. But he's going to tell us about his new podcast that he's got.
Whoa.
Hell on Earth. It is about the birth of capitalism. What year do you think that might be, Emma?
Me?
Yeah.
What, 1600s?
Bingo. Nice work. All right, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Welcome. Real pleasure to welcome back to the program. It's been a while. He is one of the hosts of Chapo Trap House. Also, one of the hosts of Hell of Presidents. It's a little play on Hall of Presidents. Yeah, I picked that up myself. And then now co-host with Chris Wade of Hell on Earth. Matt Chrisman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Hell on Earth. This is, you're going deep into history to find essentially the birth of capitalism.
Yeah, that's the idea. We're talking about the crisis of the 17th century in Europe, specifically how that manifests with the 30 Years' War and then the English Revolution, and how those struggles gave birth to this system that is able to take over the world after that.
Give us just a little bit of detail on the 30-Year War, and then I want to really get into sort of like that meld between, or I should say that transition from feudalism into capitalism.
So the 30 Years' War was 30 years long, precisely. It's not like the 100 Years' War where it's like 110 years and they just kind of rounded down. This is last from 1618 to 1648, from the defenestration of Prague when they chucked some guys out of the window to the signing of the Peace of Westphalia. And it happens in the Holy Roman Empire, which is now Germany, basically. And it's this struggle over control of what the empire would be. And the big blocks are the Catholics, represented by the Habsburg family, which had wings in Spain and in Austria, against a coalition of Protestant princes in Germany, Protestant monarchies outside of Germany, like the Swedes, all bankrolled by France, who saw it in their interest to undermine Spain specifically, who they saw as their big rival for power in Europe.
And, so are these lines, I mean, they're sectarian lines, but it really is at the end of the day about money, right? It's just that, like, this is our clan.
Yeah. I mean, the language of conflict, you know, in the popular culture of the time, the pamphlets, the books and wood carvings and stuff all use religious language and the language of Christ and Antichrist and Apocalypse. But it is fundamentally a struggle for control of a economy in deep crisis, because in the 17th century, feudalism, which was already losing its ability to manage a economic system that had gotten much more complicated, much more commercialized in the last 100 or so years, was put into even deeper crisis by a climactic disaster in the form of the Little Ice Age, a significant drop in global temperatures that helped, among other things, deeply reduce agricultural output in Europe in general. And that put every polity in Europe into this real economic crisis. And in Germany, that led to this struggle for power over this shrinking pie by these feudal overlords. And in their struggle with one another, they end up killing millions of people, destroying huge chunks of Germany, and in the process help give birth to a system that none of them could have conceived of consciously, but which was able to adjust to these changing conditions in a way that allowed for not only thriving, but eventual global domination.
So if there hadn't been that sort of like a drop in temperatures that screwed up agriculture, would we still be living under feudalism? Like, what was it? But what was, I mean, it's fun to think about. Yeah. But what was it about feudalism that couldn't adjust to that change? I mean, was it just that, like, people are blaming the system for this sort of exogenous, and I'm not advocating feudalism. I just want to make that clear. is that what was going on there?
Well, a big part of the problem is that feudalism does not have any compulsions within it to improve agricultural production. It's a system of rent extraction. And as you see in the 30 Years' War, one of the big things that causes social crisis and conflict is when you have a thing like a drop in agricultural output, the only real response is to increase the demands of taxation and levies or conquer other territory to make up for the lack. There is no intensification process. There's nothing that makes agriculture more efficient and at creating surplus from a given amount of land. Capitalism, on the other hand, throughout every level of society, creates a network of compulsions to drive people towards maximizing output and adopting efficiency and technological innovation and intensification of agricultural production. And that's what allows Europe really to escape from this cycle of destruction that had characterized the medieval period and reached its sort of bloody apotheosis in the 30 Years' War.
What was there? Were there competing? Was there any competition in terms of like how organic? Let me rephrase that. Well, I assume that the move to capitalism and finding those efficiencies, right, was relatively organic. But were there competing ideas, or was it impossible to have, let's say, some form of socialism compete in that moment because you had guys who had sort of cornered the market on swords and people to hold the swords, and they just needed to figure out how they were going to sort of move into, maintaining their power without, like, socialism would have required, like, hey, man, like, you guy with the swords, like, we should be a little bit more, we should disaggregate a little bit more of your power. That wasn't going to happen. So the requirement for the solution had to be, how do I keep my horses and my swords, guys?
Yes. There definitely were socialist strains throughout this period, and a lot of them were unleashed by the Reformation, because Martin Luther's ideas really did do a lot to dispel the mystical association between the feudal order and like God's will. And a lot of peasants specifically got the idea, like, hey, if we don't need a priest to tell us, how much we have to pray to keep our uncle out of purgatory or whatever, then why do we need a lord determining how much, where we can, how much we have to work and how much of our labor he gets? And so almost immediately after the Reformation starts, you see this wave of peasant resistance that culminates in 1525 with a peasant war in Germany that sees tens of thousands of peasants take up arms against local authorities. Secular and ecclesiastical. But they're eventually put down because the peasantry is not socially connected enough to take their resistance and make it effective. They are in pieces sort of neutralized. And by the time of the 30 Years' War, the peasantry has been really depoliticized and demoralized. Like, there are peasant revolts at the beginning of the 30 Years' War, especially in places like Austria, but those also are put down, and so that, like, peasant strain of socialism is never able to assert itself. The only alternative to the feudal order that has power is the commercial revolution that's happening in the cities among the urban literate property owners, who are taking advantage of this situation, these new capital flows and this new capital concentration that's occurring in urban areas to create revolutionary structures. And it's this conflict that unleashes them. Like, you see the Dutch revolution in finance that culminates in the creation of the Dutch East India Company, the first joint stock company in the world. That's all the context of the Dutch 80 Years' War, which started before the 30 Years' War and ended, and then the 30 Years' War began and kind of merged with the 80 Years' War, and they both ended at the same time, which was the Dutch rebellion against Spanish rule at that time. And it's in the context of trying to get revolt against the Catholic Spanish that they innovate and create these structures that then see them almost immediately overtaking their old imperial rulers and becoming this dominant economic force on the continent.
And what was the value? Like, you know, I mean, I think you know this, and it's not terribly different than it is today in some ways, but I'm reading my kid Game of Thrones, and I know it's probably not that not appropriate at his age, but I skip the really nasty parts. But, like, he asked me, he's like, I don't understand why, like, you know, when I say, like, oh, you know, the Starks have 100 swords, and, you know, they're trying to get some from River Run and this and that. And he's like, why are they fighting for these guys?
Yeah.
Like, why are they fighting for them?
And good question, Saul.
Well, it was a good question. I'm like, well, I think it's because there's not a lot of places to get food, and this is a job, but also they... And then they buy into some other ideas about honor and this and that, but a lot of it's food. I mean, is that basically it?
Like, at this point, absolutely. Like, you have what we've received in our culture of medieval warfare, like the chivalric concept, you know, honor and all that, with the knights on horseback. By the 17th century, that's pretty much gone. And it's replaced by these mercenary armies that are created by essentially financial military speculators who take money that they borrow usually and use it to front the creation of an army by buying the weapons and materials and then assigning people who need the money because at least on paper, being a soldier in this period is a better wage than you'd get as an agricultural or urban laborer. And then they would go out and fight for the side that captain was contracted for. And they would often switch sides. You see, in the 30 Years' War, there'll be a battle. One side will win, but they've lost 5,000 casualties. And if they captured a bunch of the other side's troops, they'll make up for those casualties by just having them sign up to fight in their army. So it's mostly these mercenary forces of mobile young men from the countryside and the cities who are looking for a reliable source of food, the hope of plunder and booty, because that was a big part of it. Because once you got in the field, it was hard to keep payments up. But if you took a town, you took a city, you kind of had the ability to take whatever you could. And that was a supplement to the wage and a real inducement to join the military.
And how many of those mercenary types ended up kind of getting recruited to overseas colonial exploits?
That's definitely, especially the Spanish, that's huge. The guys who the Spanish send to conquer Mesoamerica are, a lot of them are veterans of the Spanish wars on the continent and then are kind of contracted to go overseas and spread the light of Catholicism to the Americas.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the English Civil War and the Parliament and the monarchy. Yes. Give us a sense of like what drove that fight there.
It's the two sides that you see emerge in the English Civil War: Parliament and the King, the Roundheads. We're called that because of their goofy pumpkin pie haircuts and the Cavaliers with their big plumed hats. But it's really a battle between the traditional landed rural aristocracy allied with the king and these relatively new formations of capital among traders and merchants in the cities. And those are the people who dominate Parliament. Those are the people who see in the king a threat to their liberty, which meant their baseline, their ability to use these new mechanisms to enrich themselves. And so it is really this battle over who would be in charge of the economy, basically.
Is this like a Coke and Pepsi type of fight? Like, or is there something fundamentally different in the way that you know, the sort of the mercantile class, I guess, wants to how they want to organize society? Or is it really just like you're in your mafia, we're in our mafia, and we want more, you know, to wet more of our beaks?
Well, of course, they thought of it to themselves, and they spoke to it publicly in, as always, religious terms. You know, the parliamentarians were the side of the Puritans, of the Calvinists, who were horrified by the sort of pseudo crypto Catholicism of the Anglican Church that King Charles represented. So they believed themselves to have this godly mission to purify England, to purify its church. But that came with it a different understanding of government. They believed that Parliament should be supreme, that the parliamentary rule, the rule of people who had been elected by the landowners of England, because that's the only people who could vote at that point. It was still the House of Commons was still the biggest representative institution in the early modern world, but it still only represented people with at least £2 worth of property. But they believe that franchise should be in charge of the church most of all, but also the economic destiny of the state.
And that so there was contract. More of like a, there was more of an, there, there was, I mean, it's a little nascent and maybe, you know, a little, I mean, but relatively speaking, there was a more of like a democratic impetus there, right? I mean, well, you know, yeah, as far as they're willing to go, I mean, we, you know, we consider ourselves a democracy when we wouldn't allow women to vote in this country. We wouldn't allow people with property. We wouldn't allow black people to vote. It was more democratic than having a king, I guess.
Well, absolutely. And it was within itself, the movement had wings and sides. Like, as part of the process of beating the king in order to make a military machine that was capable of winning the war, the parliament created this pretty new institution, the New Model Army. And as I said, the 30 Years' War, which is happening at the same time on the continent, is fought between these mercenary forces. The New Model Army is a pretty much entirely volunteer force, and it is ideologically coherent. And it comes from, and it's made up of people, of men from all strata of English society. And eventually, the New Model Army has its own understanding of what the war is about. And it is radically democratic. And you see coming out of that the Leveller movement, which is a movement of radical army officers who, as the war is winding down, and they see the sort of government that is coming into view in Parliament, and that they're kind of horrified that it is going to be a rule by of merchants who want to impose a Scottish-style Presbyterian church on all of England, who want to focus really on they want government to focus on making everybody pray the right way while maintaining all of the basic social structures that had existed before the war. But this group of, you know, of peasants and urban workers who had fought and died for this cause said, no, this needs to create a new understanding of what liberty means. And there was this quasi-revolt against Parliament towards the end of the war, the first war. There's a couple of them. Oliver Cromwell and his son-in-law have to mediate this debate in Putney about the future of the state. And for a while, the Levellers have a real influence. But once again, it's the same thing that happened to the peasants earlier in Europe. There is not enough of a organized, coherent political institutional machinery to push forth their interests, and they end up being neutralized by the more unified leadership of the army and the more economically conservative parliamentarians. And they kind of get what they want, which is why as soon as they cut the king's head off, after he basically forces them to, because he will not take any kind of deal that they really want him to take, the government is never able to establish itself. And you have Cromwell repeatedly having to get rid of Parliament, bring in a new Parliament, and then eventually declare himself king in all but name, because the Parliament will not seriously consider doing anything to address those radical concerns that the military had. So they spend their entire time arguing over the fine points of what the church should look like. What should pastors be allowed to say on the pulpit? How much tithing should people be required to give to the church? Should there be a guy standing in the church with a big hook to pull off a preacher if he says the wrong thing? And that they spend all this time on this stuff because they will not address the social issue, and therefore they can never get a deeper embeddedness. They're never able to create like a real democratic legitimacy among these people who had fought for the war for something greater that was denied them afterwards.
So you really needed George Soros to come in and provide some institutional heft for those folks trying to push.
But you need actually a working class, and that comes into being through this process in the next century, and by the 19th century, you are able to see like this movement reassert itself with the Chartists and stuff. But at that time,
because their institutional power is the fact that their labor is so discrete, or in the sense that it's defined, mm-hmm. like these units of labor exist in such a way that they can wield it as a power rather than sort of like disparate,
because at this point,
because labor becomes an institution,
exactly,
like, within the context of capitalism.
You have laborers in the country and the city, but they're mostly working as assistants to artisans and small shops, or they're working as agricultural labor in the countryside for landowners. There is not there's not the factory system that's going to create organized blocks of workers, and that is what is necessary for the working class as such to come into itself as a political force.
And that's why
England is so precocious because of the specific way that the capitalist revolution in land tenure happens there, where you have for the first England in by this period has a situation where in the countryside feudal rents are set in the market. As opposed to in the rest of Europe, especially for example, France, land tenure is something that is, it's on a piece of paper. It's going to be there forever. You know, the only question is what percentage of your output you're going to give to the landlord. But in England, that is a market decision. And that means that if you can't keep up with market demands, you lose your land. And that means that more productive peasants, peasants who are forced to be more productive to keep their land, get more of it, and those who can't lose it and become this force of workers, both in the countryside and the city. And that is one of those things that pushes England forward. And even though it is a backwater in Europe, it's one of like the least economically valuable countries. It's like all it's got is wool, really, is able to create these institutions of governance that facilitate capitalism, while the institutions on the continent really still hinder it and try to push it apart. And it's only the eventual dominance of England that forces all the other countries of Europe to unleash these capitalist forces in order to compete with England.
Why didn't socialism, if England was that advanced in terms of capitalism and had created those institutions of workers, why didn't we see, why wasn't England necessarily where, we had the strongest and most sort of like earliest worker movement?
Colonialism. The fact that the United States, specifically North America, became this vent for the social ferment, the social conflict that otherwise
that let the air out of the tires,
yeah,
as
exactly.
It were.
The existence of the colonies creates this vent for everybody at every level of society that is unable to adjust to this new system. And it's not just workers. In fact, it's mostly these middle class Puritans at first who are unable to adjust to the reality of this new marketized life and flee to across the ocean to try to purify life in the imagined tabula rasa of North America. But eventually the colonies become this constant stress and pressure reliever for social conflict in England.
That's interesting. It's almost like the way charter schools operate.
Yeah.
We just do it, send the problem kids to Australia and to America.
Basically, yes.
And then we overperform on some level because we don't. That's basically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because what saves capitalism from its own destruction, the destruction that Marx foresaw in the 19th century, is that the social contradictions of capitalism that did market for death in Europe, and like I don't know how you see the early 20th century, which is really a second 30 years war from 1914 to 1945, as not like the apocalyptic destruction of European capitalism, if not for the existence of the United States, where that specific matrix of exploitable and expropriational land and black labor is able to neutralize a lot of the social contradictions of European capitalism and create a new social reality, a social matrix that is much more stable because it is able to vent off its own conflict through domination of an other, which doesn't really exist in Europe.
Interesting. And so the next crisis of capitalism saved by colonies on Mars.
That is why they think that way, because they understand that like without a colonial frontier, without a envisioned place to vent, there is no long-term future in this system. It has to destroy itself.
Well, here we are. Where are we on that? where are we on that timeline?
I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting about doing the Hell on Earth show is just seeing how history rhymes at this, how this moment of history rhymes with that one. Like the feudalism in terminal crisis, hit with an exogenous ecological shock, creating these specific confluence of crises, which are very recognizable today. One of the big ones is a epistemic crisis caused by the emergence of mass literacy and a new mind that emerges from people reading and understanding their world through literacy in a way that they had not before. And we're in the throes of a very similar mental crisis created by the new digital terrain, because now, you know, what is reality has changed because it is our understanding of reality is filtered through this new mediated world, the same way that theirs was.
And so, what does that bring about? I mean, and it's quite likely, it seems to me, that we are entering a period, I mean, I may not be around for it, but where there's going to be this big exogenous crisis in the form of climate change. Do you think that, and I get, you know, it's hard to sense that, you know, there's no, I guess, magic number or sort of like, you know, things will start turning to a certain hue of color. But like, those organic forces that exist, is the power dispersed enough on some level? We don't have that same situation where there's, you know, a couple of guys with most of the horses and most of the swords, as it were.
Right.
Because that, you know, we have a couple of guys with the money, but it doesn't necessarily, it's not quite as efficient as swords and horses. Right. To get people to move. Do you think that dispersion will be there and that the ideas are there? I mean, because that's really the question, is like, what comes out of the ruins of these things? And I guess, you know, my analogy is like late antiquity, because that's just happened to be what I had studied at one point when, you know, Judaism becomes based on the Torah, because you don't really have many other options. You don't have access to the temple anymore, and you've been scattered around. So this is just what, you know, this is the solution that comes out of that. I mean, like when you look at what exists today, what is the likelihood of what that next iteration of the way that we are organized becomes?
I mean, that's
the next podcast you're going to do?
That's a very good question. And I honestly don't know the thing that keeps me from like getting too fixated on trying to figure that out is the fact that looking back and watch and analyzing how this happened then, and recognizing how the system that is emerging to meet these challenges is happening underneath the conscious awareness of any of the participants. Like, everybody who's doing this struggle thinks that they're defending a way of life. Meanwhile, every act they take is actually dooming it and building a new thing that they would never have thought of or tried to advance if they'd known about it. And I assume that that is basically how it works, and that we right now are building structures to deal with crisis, to move through it, that we consciously cannot be even aware of, but that it is happening. Like, I just found out, or my sister, I'm visiting family, who's gotten deep into Ancestry.com. She's like clicking on all the leaves, and she was able to find a ninth great grandfather who was in Baden-Württemberg, which is like ground zero for the 30 Years' War. During the 30 Years' War, he was a military barber surgeon in the 30 Years' War.
Wow.
From an area that had, during the course of the war, lost 58% of its population from migration, plague, the war, famine. And here I am, you know?
That's into your barber business.
I should become one. I don't know. I'm not very good with hair, but you know, I just think of it in those terms. Like, the human project is bigger than any crisis we can throw at it, just because life is insistent upon itself. But our ability as discrete historical actors to understand where we are is very limited, and really understanding only comes in the aftermath of massive changes.
Well, all right. On that note, let's talk about the Fox News text. I mean, since we've bumped up against our limitations as a species in trying to assess any further, that's and people should just wait for the sequel, I guess, on the podcast, where you presumably will be able to go into depth as to where we're headed in that respect. I'm making that up. I don't want to put undue pressure on you for that, but it's fascinating. And the way that different systems grow out of the catastrophic failure of other, you know, the systems that precede it, to me it's fascinating, and, you know, gives people an opportunity to at least, you know, place some bets on where we're headed. You may not be around for the payoff, but worth doing. And it also, like, to me, what those stories show is the value of doing stuff that seems presumably futile in the moment.
Yeah,
but you're setting up stuff. And that works both on, like, sort of like that grander scale, but even, like, you know, in the context of more sort of like mundane and narrow and banal, like, hey, it's a good idea to be talking about, you know, how you would structure a Medicare for All program, even though there's no chance that we can look at this in this moment and think that it's actually going to happen, because we can't predict when the opportunity rises, and if there's enough broad-based support, then maybe it happens.
Yeah, I mean, you can't give up, because if you're waking up every day, you are having some sort of tacit agreement that, you know, you're going to move through life and face its challenges, and you have to do that in good faith, and that means you can't concern yourself too much with you know, possibilities, because you are filling in those blanks, and you can't really know, but you can know, you know, who the people in your life are, what the issues in your life are that matter to you, and you have no choice really but to engage them on their own terms.
All right, so let's have a little, like, palate cleansing with these things. Fox News could be in big trouble. We were talking about this with Ryan Grimm. I mean, they have plenty of cash on hand, but, you know, there's no, and Dominion's only looking for $1.6 billion. But there's no, you know, a jury could say theoretically, like, you know what, we actually think it should be double that. And then there would be a real problem. But let's put up some of these tweets. I want to get your reaction to this. I mean, I assume you know the basic outlines of the story, even though you've been living in a different century. This is a defamation lawsuit that Dominion Voting has filed. They have suffered a lot of like damages, presumably because they're too controversial to be hired anywhere because of all their supposed, according to Fox News or some of these outlets, that they've been sending, you know, Hugo Chavez was controlling their service from the dead and then sending it to like a German closet. And
that's my favorite one of them. Is the,
which one was it?
Is the white hat, there's a white hat, black hat gunfight at a server farm in Germany. I remember when they said that happened.
Oh, is there actually a gunfight in front of it?
That was part of like at, right around the election. They were like, yeah, the white hat army guys have gone in and they've had a shootout with CIA mercs at a server farm in Germany to get the hard drives or whatever.
I mean, this is just like spy fan fiction at this point.
Why not? Have fun with it.
And some of the stuff in Discovery has now been released. A lot of it's redacted for some reason, which is also I'm just fascinated by. Like, what could be redacted? But some of these quotes from Tucker Carlson and the crew are really amazing. But put up what you got, Bradley, because I haven't seen those. But we read with Ryan Grimm the thing that Carlson was complaining about a Fox reporter who fact checked Donald Trump on Dominion. And he said, you got to get her fired because the stock price of the company is going down.
Yeah. Even though
I'm also sort of fascinated by, like, why does he give a shit?
Yeah.
Like, well, honestly,
he might have. Do you think he has equity? I mean, that could be part of his compensation package. He makes tens of millions of dollars a year plus some stock options. I'm not sure.
I guess. But I mean, like, is he got like margin calls? Like, what's going on? Like, why so freaked out about the stock price?
He is a team player.
I mean, that's what's sort of amazing about this. Like, when I worked for Air America, I was like, I don't care what happens to you people. Like, just pay me my money. I don't care. Like, you know, I'm doing my job. You do yours. I was impressed with that he cared that much about the Fox family. But let's put up a couple of these tweets.
Here he calls Trump a, quote, demonic force, a destroyer, but he's not going to destroy us.
After January 6th, trying to thread the needle between the truth and pressure from his viewers and sponsors became even more difficult. Late on January 6th, Carlson texted with Pfeiffer that Trump is, quote, a demonic force, a destroyer, but he's not going to destroy us. On January 26th, Carlson invited his leading sponsor, Mike Lindell, on his show, where Lindell spotted the same conspiracies on air after previewing them for Carlson's staff during a pre-interview.
Put up another one. I mean, what these are just so awesome. I mean, I don't see how they don't settle at this point. I'd be terrified. It's so clear that they knew that they were just putting garbage on there. Put up the next one, Greg.
Yeah, Hannity told Carlson and Ingram on November 12th, in 1 week and one debate, they destroyed a brand that took 25 years to build and damages an incalculable. It's vandalism. The hosts also discussed the possibility of competition to Fox emerging. Hannity told them serious money with serious distribution could be a real problem. In my humble opinion, they need to address. So they're concerned about competition there.
Now, wait a second. To be clear, they're worried that they ruin the brand by saying that there was no fraud in the election. Is that what it is?
I guess so. If they're worried about competitors, yeah. Like,
right. They were worried about Newsmax in particular, which is hilarious. I mean,
that's why you bring Lindell on,
and that's why I don't think they'll settle, Sam. They have a paranoid fighter mentality where they're gonna just go be aggressive and blitz as opposed to settling right away, which is good for us. But
wait,
this reminds me. Of the fact of their relationship, it reminds me of their fundamental relationship to their viewer base and how they are always on the back foot, really, because the idea of Fox News that emerged in the Bush era as like this consent manufacturing device. And at one point, it might have done that. It might have like acculturated seniors to this worldview. But once it had done that, they lost their ability to shape it. Because in 2016, the initial Fox News editorial line was that Trump was a Democrat, a New York fancy boy, and we don't take him seriously. And they had to change that because the viewers were like, no, he rules. He's talking about immigration. He's saying the stuff that these other people won't. And then they had to say, ah, what was that? No, we think he's great. And now they're stuck in this relationship with them.
It is fascinating because, the most obvious analogy is that, you know, Frankenstein is now running through the Frankenstein they created. He's got his own agenda now. Yeah. And part of it was the split between Fox. You know, Fox came out of the right-wing talk radio world, but it became like, because it became TV, it got a little bit cleaved from that. Mm-hmm. And Trump is completely, or was completely, a product of talk radio. Yeah, I mean, you listen to like Mark Levin and Ingram and them, and you would hear everything that Trump was echoing. The anti-immigrant stuff, you never heard talk radio really talk about Social Security that much. I mean, most of that stuff had to be like from Paul Ryan, who was invited on TV. I mean, when you're on TV, you needed a different level of like, propriety, I guess. And that got them cleaved from their base. Pop up this next one. This guy, Alex Pfeiffer, is Tucker's assistant.
And so just to give you some context about this one, as a result of the first one we just looked at, Hannity and Tucker were talking about how Fox called Arizona much earlier for Biden than they did than any other outlet. That was, they were concerned about that affecting the brand. But in private, Tucker was saying that Powell and Giuliani and others are lying and like deranged, but they didn't want that to come across on air. So here he tells his producer, Alex Pfeiffer, that Sidney Powell is lying and calls her a fucking bitch.
I mean, it felt like that came across on air, too.
Yeah.
I don't know. To me, it did. Let's see what else. Yeah,
you can keep going.
You got one more?
Yeah, keep going. Sorry, Matt. And so Hannity confirmed that every day he and his team do a very deep analysis of ratings to see audience reaction to certain stories or guests. The ratings are important. We look at the ratings every day. Hannity told Steve Doocy Fox had created major backlash with the audience after the 2020 election, stating, "You don't piss off the base." He likewise texted Carlson and Laura Ingram, "The network is being rejected." Carlson responded, "I've heard from angry viewers every hour of the day all weekend, including at dinner tonight," to which Hannity replied, "Same, same, same. Never before has this ever happened."
He's tucking into a sirloin and some guy's yelling at him from across the restaurant.
It's like, imagine where the guy's eating, right?
Yeah, like, he's like, I didn't expect this in Midtown, right?
That's so fantastic. Is there any more?
There's this part of Romo stuff that's pretty wild.
All right.
Enter Maria Bartiromo. On Sunday, November 8th, Bartiromo hosted Sidney Powell on Sunday Morning Futures, where Powell claimed that Dominion software had an algorithm used as part of, quote, a massive coordinated effort to steal this election from Trump. Bartiromo told Powell, "I know that there were voting irregularities. Tell me about that." Bartiromo knew Powell would respond with conspiracy theories about Dominion. On November 7th, Bartiromo had interviewed Powell, and then we get a redacted section. I don't know how to interpret that. What was the evidence from these far-fetched claims that Powell sent to Bartiromo the day before the broadcast? An email entitled "Election Fraud Info" Powell had received from a source, which another author herself described as pretty wackadoodle. The email also received by Dobbs alleged Dominion was the one common thread in the voting. Is there more to that? Irregularities in a number of states. Barter, in addition to promoting lies about Dominion, the sender claimed that Justice Scalia, quote, was purposefully killed at the annual Bohemian Grove camp during a week-long human hunting exhibition. Now, my understanding is he was killed at a ranch in Texas, so Bohemian Grove's in California, but interesting. And that Fox...
dude, you're pretending like there isn't an underground portal.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Whatever.
So they were doing like a human hunting of Scalia, which, you know, I guess
I mean,
was Dick Cheney there?
And Rupert Murdoch secretly, Ailes and Murdoch secretly huddle most days to determine how best to portray Mr. Trump as badly as possible. The other continued, "Who am I? And how do I know all of this? I've had the strangest dream since I was a little girl. I was internally decapitated, and yet I live. The wind tells me I'm a ghost, but I don't believe it." So.
All right. I have a couple of questions. What does it mean to be internally decapitated? Wait, did we lose?
We did lose Matt.
Yeah, Matt's internet might have dropped. I'll text him to see if we can get him back.
Okay. What does it mean to be internally decapitated?
I don't know, but I mean, there's some poetry in that, honestly.
It's hard to describe, Sam, because you're not really a spiritual being. And so it's sort of like describing physics to a dog.
Thank you. The wind does not talk to me.
Exactly, yeah.
The wind has been completely giving me
those of us who the wind does talk to, we know not
shoulder,
always to trust the
wind. As it were.
You're not on that frequency, you understand, right?
No, yeah, I don't get any of that. When Carlson wrote to Ingram, Sidney Powell is lying, by the way, I caught her, it's insane. Is she saying that she's lying about the servers? Like what? And then Ingram says, Sidney is a complete nut. No one will work with her. Ditto with Rudy. Our viewers are good people and they believe it, Carlson said, making it clear that he did not. Well, that's because you're promoting it.
Yeah. Because of the signs like the messages you're sending, buddy. They're your
because viewers. You have yeah. aggrandized Giuliani because they all laid the foundation for this big vote stealing thing. It's amazing to watch this come back on them.
Yeah,
I'm really, really amazing. All right, do we have Matt or no? That's it.
Yeah, his hotel Wi-Fi dropped out. It seems so. Might not be able to get him back.
Okay. Well, tell him thank you.
Yeah, of course I will.
Well, I guess we're going to do Freebie Friday.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost two.
Almost two. Yeah, that was plenty. We spent a lot of time.
But we should say shop.majorityreportradio.com. I'm being good here because the pre-order ends on Sunday night at midnight.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, so for the M-Majority shirts, get them while you can. Shop.majorityreportradio.com.
You're on top of this stuff more than I am. Mm-hmm. I am in pre-vacation mode, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. It's not going to be it's vacation, but it's not vacation-y. Let's put it that way. I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff. But what should we get to here?
I think that maybe we want to just go right into Jimmy Dore on Tim Pool.
Oh, let's do that. Sure. I just saw an IM too that apparently he was on. He's been doing the rounds. I guess he's doing like a tour.
Yeah.
And let's see. Where was that? He went on the PBD podcast. I'm not sure what that is. And rated Ron Paul, Tulsi Gabbard, and Matt Gaetz and Trump more anti-establishment than AOC and Bernie Sanders.
Ah.
I mean, like,
but who
this
cares
is the problem.
About being anti-establishment?
Well, what does it mean to be anti-establishment? Like, what
it means you don't want to actually take on capitalism.
This is the classic reactionary mind.
Mm-hmm.
It is the classic reactionary mind, which is you portray yourself as anti-establishment to reassert the pre-existing order of things.
Yes.
Like, okay. Tulsi Gabbard, I don't know exactly what she's railing against, but fundamentally, if you believe that the establishment is made up of capital controlling our society, if you believe that white men have controlled our society, if you believed that some people are, you know, historically marginalized, this is what these people are pushing is to just simply reestablish that exact same different sets of hierarchies. There's no, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard and Matt Gaetz and Ron Paul, for that matter, are not going to assert the power of workers in any meaningful way. I mean, maybe not even a non-meaningful way.
But and this is really just like, you can't really like say there's zero difference in the parties, although that's still sort of what he repeats. But he's actually saying that Republicans are better.
Yes.
And it's like, that's a theory.
It is a theory. Let's listen.
Government, do you know how much money that is? That's like 10 grand a week they pay him. That's 40 grand a month.
He's talking
remember
about
when the
here.
Left was
maybe let's go back a little bit. Yeah, just because he's making a point. If we could go back even like a minute, about how he was around skeptical people his entire life, and now they've completely bought into an establishment narrative on COVID. Once again, we'll just bring this back to being anti-establishment is facile,
sorry,
but it's not tethered to like anti-capitalism or to challenging bosses.
It's also in agreement with both parties, and you get your ass back to work. Like,
yeah.
this is the establishment. Like, it's just the flu. You are overreacting, and go serve. You know, the Chicago Public Schools Union. Like that. Like, that's what it is.
And to be clear, like, what is the establishment supposedly gaining out of COVID here? Like, I get the fact that this is an opportunity for vaccine companies to make money. There's no doubt that they are. Government, the government should have basically said, we're capping your profits.
Mm-hmm.
We're investing this money in there, and we're capping your profits. Period. End of story. There's no doubt. And certainly, we've always argued for that, and there
we've
should have been
for waiving intellectual,
no patent,
yeah,
no intellectual
right,
property associated yeah. with it, all of these things. But what is the value to government about, you know, about the existence of COVID being real? And let's be clear, the government was the Trump administration through that first year. I have no doubt that, you know, Trump was interested in, he's probably agnostic as to anybody making money if it isn't associated with him in many ways. But I mean, it is this fantasy that COVID was some type of like control mechanism, that there weren't like that this was a plan by government to control people, as opposed to, there may be failures of responses in different areas because of the nature of a once in literally a lifetime pandemic. Hopefully it will be going forward as well. But it's so, if you follow the thread, the premise, you realize this is Alex Jones territory, period.
Well, it's interesting because he's reevaluated his infamous interaction with Alex Jones.
This is
probably because it's new bedfellows. But
this is also directly in the face of, say, the Amazon union or Starbucks workers saying we need more protections and stuff like that. Like, this is a pro boss. Like, the idea that this is anti-establishment. Like, there are people who aren't as sort of Marxist as I want, but like, they are sort of anti-establishment. This is pro-establishment. Right
yeah,
now, like
right.
he should be applauding like Joe Biden's like, no, come on, man, let's get back to work, because that's what he wanted.
Audience to please people like us, so they write these crazy hit pieces that say that YouTube is radicalizing children to be Nazis and pedophiles and white supremacists and right wingers mm-hmm. and all this stuff, and people are like, oh, and that's why all of a sudden overnight they dropped all their advertising on YouTube.
Yeah.
Overnight that happened, and why did they do that? Because we're actually a threat to them, and so
pause
now
it,
we have
it,
all these rules
it.
Of
okay
how-
now I remember when this happened, and you know, even the supposed establishment shills, we also had our advertising dropped. And the fact of the matter is,
concerns.
It is completely the case that YouTube radicalizes some people. And some people get unradicalized from the radicalization they've had on YouTube via YouTube as well.
Do you remember Caleb Kane? Jimmy Dore interviewed Caleb.
Yes, and cut our name out of Caleb Kane's mouth because he didn't want to do it. But he also wanted Caleb Kane to say, like, wasn't this story bullshit? And Caleb was like, no, actually, that's what happened to me. Right. But the idea that this was an attack on independent, it was advertisers don't want to be associated when they're called out for being associated with Nazis.
Yeah.
Then with fascists and with bigots, they don't want to.
And the reality is that
business.
The Daily Wire is still on there, and we know for a fact from the manifesto from the Quebec shooter, right, who shot up the mosque, that he one of his the things he was most interested in viewing was Ben Shapiro,
particularly Ben Shapiro. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, of course, it has this impact, and of course,
actually,
advertisers.
This is just for fun. We're doing this. It actually has no impact on the real world. I'm just sitting here making money. Like, is that his theory?
Yeah,
well,
I guess.
That, and then the other thing, too, is that, like, if what you're doing has this import, then the money is secondary.
Mm-hmm. Well,
right?
It is interesting.
Theoretically.
Yeah, let's let him go because I find it interesting that he decided to bring up Fauci's paychecks when we know how much money Jimmy Dore makes on anti-vax misinformation.
Well, you know, to be honest with you, the top epidemiologist in the country, the guy who's in charge of deploying our stuff, like, yes. I think it's okay for that person to be making $400,000 to $500,000 a year in the context of our system because. He's going to go into the private sector and make five times that.
Yes. Ronny Jackson, who is a congressman from Texas, tweeted out, how did Fauci make millions during the pandemic? We're going to find out. And then there's a CNN business article. A new billionaire has been minted nearly every day during the pandemic. So Fauci is really playing small ball and dropping some bags here.
Right.
He's making that.
He just doesn't have a good business mind, I guess.
And why did they do that? Because we're actually a threat to them. And so now we have all these rules of how we can talk and how we'll, and it's the, you know, the old saying is who you can't criticize rules over you. Well, we can't criticize the COVID narrative in the way it deserves to be on YouTube. And who owns that? That's Big Pharma. So you can't, Big Pharma has captured the FDA. Big Pharma has captured the CDC. But Fauci is a pathological liar and criminally corrupt. That's why he's been able to have that job for 43 years. And he's the highest paid person in government. He makes almost $500,000 a year in government. Do you know how much money that is? That's like 10 grand a week they pay him. That's 40 grand a month.
He can calculate.
Remember
that
when
kind of
the left,
you know,
was
how much money he's making at? So hold a pause on. Pause it. How much money he's making as a YouTube guy or the guy Tim Pool he's sitting next to?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, if Tim Pool was making $10,000 a week, there would be alarm bells going off in his studio. Like the idea that Tim Pool at Fusion was making $250,000 a year more than Fauci. And I can assure you that Tim Pool is making that money times, I don't know, X. But it's not one, and it's not two.
Yeah.
I mean, you're worried about Anthony Fauci making $10,000 a week. If Tim Pool, and I bet Jimmy Dore, was making $10,000 a week, that would be like a five-alarm fire for, like, our business is going down the tubes.
But, and this is why he's like such a moron, because like he's making that in government. Like, bro, I think our government officials should, that's just,
they should be making the most.
Yes.
Right. To stave off like the revolving door where you have people have to leave to go to private to get their paychecks.
Like that's a huge problem. Like where like Texas does it, like has, like you basically have to be rich in order to serve in the Texas legislature because it doesn't pay enough.
Yeah.
$1 million a year in government. Do you know how much money that is? That's like 10 grand a week they pay him. That's 40 grand a month.
Remember when the left was concerned about massive multinational corporations like Big Pharma and would call out Big Pharma specifically for, like, I don't know, the fines they've had to pay over the criminal actions they've taken? But now for some reason, you know where I'm going with this.
Yes.
What happened?
So people who have...
New young people came up in allegiance?
These people who I know all my life, who are supposed to be critical and skeptical of big business and big pharma and military, they have They have question authority bumper stickers, and then they shame you if you question the authority on COVID. It's like, what is going on? People who still think that we haven't landed on the moon don't want you to question the COVID narrative. Mm-hmm. It's the craziest thing. I don't know what happened, but everybody I know.
Which is why he's questioning Big Pharma by advocating for hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which are not something that you would actually have to pay for, is my understanding.
Yeah,
the government is not paying billions and billions of dollars for the mass manufacturing of hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. No, what they did was they did that for COVID vaccines because they were effective. And so until May 11th or whenever the emergency authorization runs out, you can get a vaccination for free without insurance.
Yeah. We need to stand against pharma by doing prophylactic ivermectin trials for $25 a month. And like, this is, let's be explicit about like why pharma is okay with Jimmy Dore here. The real demands that we should be making to pharma is the vaccine is a public, freely available good, and that IP is shared throughout the world. All of this bullshit about is it secretly killing you? Like, that's doing cover for pharma. That's like,
totally.
That's like, that's what this is. So Jimmy is a pro pharma flack right now.
Totally. And let's also be clear. Part of the reason why those people with the question authority were probably like open to the idea of a vaccine was the nearly 500,000 people who died prior to the deployment of that vaccine.
Yeah. They questioned people authority and then
saw
came to
refrigerator 18 wheelers in New York City because there wasn't enough room for the dead bodies that were in this city that, you know, before people started like distancing and wearing masks and staying at home and not going into crowded places, there was mass death in places where people were concentrated in this country. That tends to make you think like, okay, we need a solution here. And even if people were too like sort of readily willing to accept what, you know, a Big Pharma was doing here, there is absolutely no evidence that the vaccine is anything but better than getting COVID.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And certainly, we should have limited their profits or had an upside on it or owned it or whatever it was. And we've talked about that ad nauseum. But the idea that the mere existence of it, and I don't know anybody who has spent more time on Big Pharma malfeasance in the context of lawsuits and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I did a show with the biggest tort attorney in the country for years. I would go to that tort conference every year, hear story after story after these things. But the bottom line is that there are medicines. I find it very hard to believe that Jimmy Dore doesn't take any medicine from Big Pharma that are effective. And you need to sort of like make an argument instead of just sort of saying, Big Pharma are corporate and are willing to risk people, risk the health of people because they are. But also, I'll take an Avid. I mean, Advil. I will take I will take Ambien. I will take whatever, like a whole host of medicines.
You'll exist in society.
Well, like, but it's but it's also just sort of like the idea that there is everything that pharma puts out. Because that's what you'd have to believe. You'd have to believe the idea that, as just a blanket statement, that everything that pharma produces is a fiction. And there is absolutely no recourse. That is not the case.
No.
It is simply
again, he's advocating over and over again and has been for pharmaceutical products made by the same damn manufacturers of these vaccines on his program time and time again.
Continue.
Yeah.
What is going on? People who still think that we haven't landed on the moon don't want you to question the COVID narrative. Mm-hmm. It's the craziest thing. I don't know what happened, but everybody I know who were the biggest cynics, comedians, they lost their cynicism. They lost their healthy sense of skepticism about people who we've always known were the biggest corrupt criminals in the world. Tim, you know that. I mean, when I say criminals, I mean, did they put asbestos in baby powder and then sell it to poor people after they got fired? Yes, that's the kind of shit they did. I mean, did they put AIDS-tainted stuff in blood and sent to poor countries? Yes, they did. They gave people a. Did they give sell you heart medicine they knew was going to give you a heart attack? Mm-hmm. Yes, they knew it, and they did it anyways. So what would be any different than now? It turns out fucking nothing, except they. Oh, I'm sorry, right? Effing nothing. But they have more control of the media. How much has they made $100 billion off of COVID? That's it. One company, Pfizer, made $100 billion off of COVID. Do you know how much the entire recording music industry makes in the United States? $12 billion a year. Every record, everything. That's how much they made off of one COVID. So, you know what kind of power that gives you? That gives you the power to buy every person in the media, which they did. They bought everybody in the government, which they did. They just got in California, which is super majority Democrat with a Democrat governor. They passed a law telling doctors they're not allowed to practice medicine that goes against what Big Pharma says when it comes to COVID. And if they do, they're going to get fined. So they're taking the ability to practice medicine away from doctors because they're so corrupted.
Yep.
I mean, and that's the end of the show, everyone. Thanks for coming.
That's just the beginning.
We've been lied to about COVID on a scale that our brains can't even comprehend. And people are just now starting to comprehend.
This is where it leads to. This is where it leads to. Because his whole argument is that COVID itself is fake. That it's not really a bad disease.
How many people would Jimmy admit died from COVID?
And they all, I mean, half, maybe a little bit of half now, but in terms of like year over year, I mean, it was nine months, March till like December when the first vaccine came out. We'll just call it 9 months. How many people died in those 9 months? Was that just like a fiction? We don't care.
Right.
He would say it's Pharma lying about the death count.
That's the question. Like, he will not address that because it undercuts his entire argument, which is that this is a plandemic. This guy is like full on plandemic. And it's not a question. And here's the thing. This is why we would say it like all the time. That if Alex Jones didn't exist, the CIA would create him. Because instead of like looking at the relationship between the government funding that vaccine development, and not just COVID, but like mRNA technologies, which is they're going to make a lot of money on its treatment for cancers. Ultimately, there's no doubt. Instead of focusing on that, like we should be owning part of that product. It suddenly becomes like this sort of, you can't even trust medicine or government. This is to undercut government ultimately, because you cannot have a plandemic unless government is fundamentally evil.
Exactly.
And that is a right-wing project, period, end of story. Government is evil. Instead of like, there are elements within government that are problematic, just like there's elements within any institution that are problematic. Instead of like, we need a communal response to many problems in government. What he is doing is really no different than what Grover Norquist would do. Continue.
That our brains can't even comprehend, and people are just now starting to comprehend.
Well, let's talk about the media. So I hate to actually talk about some of these people because they don't deserve the attention, but you worked with the Young Turks for a long time, and I've known them for a bit. And the interesting thing is that it's not just the corporate press that we've seen all of a sudden. Look, we know that everything's brought to you by Pfizer. We know the unholy satanic dancing or whatever performance was brought to you by Pfizer. We know that all these talk shows are brought to you by Pfizer. Yes. I get it. But what happened to independent media outlets like the Young Turks, where all of a sudden they went from being the counterculture to towing the line for the establishment?
I just think Trump happened, and so they became, you're either with us or against us. and they didn't want to be on the outside. It's cult thinking now to be a Democrat and a Democratic voter. It's a cult thinking.
Pause it for a moment. Where's the logic here? Trump is the one who developed the vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
If there were a, if it was you're with us or you're against this, then we'd be against the vaccine.
They should be, right?
Warp speed.
I will also say that, like, we've never, we do not do any pharmaceuticals on this program, I don't think. Nutrafol, that's all vitamins.
Yeah.
The idea, and I don't know about Young Turks, but the idea that, somehow, you know, Big Pharma is paying, no. Actually, no. I mean, I've gotten some free vaccines. But that was not.
How about this? No. Jimmy's bought by the National Restaurant Association to downplay a virus. That's my accusation. We want to throw around accusations like that. Jimmy's bought by the National Restaurant Association.
It certainly benefited them. Also, Amazon.
Yeah, that too. And I'm not. All the groups attempting to undermine teachers' unions.
Oh yeah, Lori Lightfoot.
Charter schools.
It's Lori Lightfoot. Lori Lightfoot. Stand.
Yeah. Right.
Continue.
You're either with us or against us. And they didn't want to be on the outside. It's cult thinking now to be a Democrat and a Democratic voter. It's a cult thinking now. Now I criticize the Democrats because I was a Democrat my whole life up until 2016 when they cheated Bernie in the primary and then Bernie didn't make him pay a price for it. And not only that, he didn't make him reform, right? They still have superdelegates. They still take corporate money. They still do all that stuff that screwed him and he'll never use his leverage to. So I stopped being a Democrat. And so it's very cult-like thinking. People are afraid to push back and have a different thought. And if you do, it's like you're one of them. So everything, you're either with us or against us, is very tribal thinking. And it leads to the country we have, where half the country can't afford a $500 emergency and people are living under every bridge. And we still are told to hate our neighbor. Mm-hmm. We're told that our neighbor is the cause of our problem, even though the establishment did a controlled demolition of our economy, which crushed everybody except for a handful of millionaires. And they want me to be angry because of the pain I'm feeling. They want me to be angry at my neighbor because he wouldn't take a vaccine that didn't work the way they said it did in the first place. And so I'm not going to blame my neighbor for that. What I'm going to do is love my neighbor, and I'm going to find common ground with my neighbor because we have it. And that's what scares the hell out of the oligarchy, is that if we come together and realize we have a common enemy, which is like what we're going to do on Sunday at this anti-war rally, people of all political stripes are coming together to oppose the military-industrial complex, which has been fleecing this country for at least the last 30 years.
What is this rally specifically, is it about Ukraine and or what?
And let me just say, for YouTube, the vaccine is safe and effective, and it certainly does stop and slow the transmission and contraction. It'll keep you from getting seriously ill or hospitalized.
And talk to a doctor about
and
what's
talk
right
to a
for
doctor
you.
About what's
sponsored by. Fill in the blank.
No. In all seriousness, talk to a doctor. You know,
and my, you know, the vaccine is so
Tim,
good.
Was that Tim actually doing it? Was that Tim actually being like, but seriously?
Seriously, talk to a doctor. The no mention of like, oh, incidentally, a lot of people can't afford to talk to a doctor.
Yeah.
And they're even less so after the emergency is going to be ended. The state of emergency for COVID is going to be rescinded in May, and it's going to be a lot more expensive mm-hmm. for anywhere from 5 to 15 million people to have access to a doctor. In fact, they won't basically be able to afford access to a doctor. Continue.
And it certainly does stop and slow the transmission and contraction. It'll keep you from getting seriously ill or hospitalized.
And talk to a doctor about
and
what's right for you.
Talk to a doctor about what's
sponsored by. Fill in the blank.
No. In all seriousness, talk to a doctor. You know.
And my, the vaccine is so good, my heart swells with pride.
You got the vaccine.
With
sorry,
pride.
Pause.
Yes.
Like, Jimmy does this all the time. He reposted, you can look on his feed yesterday, some anti-vax moron saying, look at all these heart stuff that happened from 2020 on. Yeah, it's COVID. COVID causes worse myocarditis in the vaccines. Right. Myocarditis from the vaccines is generally way less severe than COVID, than from COVID. And COVID actually causes these heart attacks. And Jimmy Dore has been covering it, downplaying this virus, calling it the flu the entire time. And to the extent that he's persuaded anyone not to get the vaccine, he's led their heart to be in way more jeopardy than it needs to be.
And we should say also, there's no evidence that there is an increase in like athletes. It's just that now people are sensitive to it.
Yes. There's there's this Died Suddenly documentary. And one of the very first things that they include is this kid dropping on a basketball court as in 2019.
There you go. All right. We don't need to see any more of that.
Yeah.
I really hate that guy. My God.
Yes.
I do think like he's doing this stuff, like he posted this NBC News article saying the truth is coming out now. If you read the story, it's like actually Omicron has led to like as compared to the earlier virus leads to like infection with Omicron leads to less reinfection. But even in that same article, which is about the different in the varieties, it says, yeah, you still want to get vaccinated because even though this protects you from potential reinfection as well as vaxes do, you still run the risk of it killing you the first time way more than being vaccinated.
Right. Exactly. The NBC story says that, yes, like you say, Omicron gives you more protection from reinfection or serious illness than the wild type. And maybe slightly even more than the vaccine, but the vaccine exposes you to far less danger of actually dying when you get COVID or long-term problems with it when you get COVID.
And he can't admit that because that's fundamentally blows up his entire thing.
Of course. What should we do? Candace Owens?
Let me check. Well, yeah, I mean...
Or this Matt Walsh compilation.
Oh, yeah, the Matt Walsh, yeah.
Yeah.
Matt Walsh was brought in to testify in Tennessee State Health Committee. This is compiled by the Tennessee Holler Twitter account. This is testimony presumably about some horrible law that Tennessee is contemplating about trans people or children in terms of getting care. And here's Matt Walsh brought in and embarrassed based upon his utter lack of knowledge about what he's talking about. We played that clip of him on Rogan where his... What did he say?
Millions of kids were undergoing transition care in this country. And because there had been like a week or two earlier controversy about Joe Rogan spreading the litter boxes in schools conspiracy theory, claiming that he had heard it from somebody who was actually a teacher or secondhand, something like that, they actually did a fact check. And it was something like 5,000 or in the thousands over a 5-year period.
Yes.
So Matt Walsh, expert asked to testify on trans care, did a documentary, went to Africa to ask people about what a woman is. This is his beat. Doesn't know basic facts about how many kids are undergoing trans affirming care in this country, but still expert witness in Tennessee.
Can you give us a summary of your educational background or your healthcare education?
I didn't go to college, but I did go to school long enough to learn how to read so I can read the data for myself. And that's exactly what I've done.
And for what purpose do you conduct your research and use this brain of yours?
I use it for the purpose of trying to protect children from being castrated and mutilated.
You don't use it to get clicks?
Well, are you using it right now to try to get clicks with this interaction?
You know, if you're going to come before a committee and make mischaracterizations and misrepresentations, it's fair game for us to ask you your educational background.
You seem to have started this, so you have no medical background, correct?
No.
You're trying to address good public policy, correct?
Yes.
I just have to question, you know, some of your public policy. Singapore is able to have nice things in part because they execute drug dealers by hanging and arrest even petty vandals and thieves and beat them with a cane until they bleed. We don't have nice things here because we aren't willing to do what is required to maintain them. I kind of have to question your public policy beliefs. And you also stated there'd been no studies. Well, I'm sitting here holding a study from the American Academy of Pediatrics, suicide societal disparities between transgender and cisgender adults and children. Before you state things, you may need to know all the facts.
On your blog, at about 16, you're an adult who's mature and can make decisions. You're that at 16. I don't care what anybody says, even going so far as to say when you're 16, you should be married and pregnant. 16 is an adult in your view. Why does this bill have minor defined as 18?
I was a radio host 13, 14 years ago in my early 20s. It's also not an accurate reflection of what I actually said. I was talking about the fact.
They're going to play, I think, in this clip, right? Doesn't it follow up with what he actually said?
Yeah, they play what he actually said.
I was a radio host. And one wonders what he's trying to... But one wonders what he's trying to suggest there. He's either trying to suggest that, like, I was just shooting from the hip. I mean, I didn't say what you said I said, but if I was, I was just shooting from the hip because that's the way you do on radio. Or maybe he's saying, like, it was my job to spew bullshit.
Yeah.
Now that I'm on YouTube.
Yeah, right.
There's far greater standards.
Yeah, I was on FCC monitored radio. So I was, you know, shooting wildly there, but now I'm on YouTube.
Yeah.
Now he's making a lot of money.
Now he's an expert. So, but also 13 years ago, his lack of credentials or knowledge about basic subjects, I mean, should not be taken seriously. But even though he hasn't updated any of his credentials, now he should be testifying to take trans-affirming care away from kids.
He's been around the block.
Right, right. That put some millions in his pocket is what he means.
He's mature and can make decisions. You're that at 16. I don't care what anybody says. Even going so far as to say when you're 16, you should be married and pregnant. 16 is an adult in your view. Why does this bill have minor defined as 18?
I was a radio host 13, 14 years ago in my early 20s. It's also not an accurate reflection of what I actually said. I was talking about the fact that people tended to marry young historically, and that's all that was about. How does that relate to this? To all of a sudden act like this phenomenon of girls getting pregnant at a young age that we consider young, 16 or 17, to act like it's a new thing is ridiculous. It's always been that way. Girls between the ages of like 17 and 24 is when they're technically most fertile. Recently, in the last 30 years or so, we decided that's way too young to start a family. So what I'm saying is that the problem is not per se teenage pregnancy. It's unwed pregnancy. That's the problem in society.
So in other words, what he was saying is that it historically it was this way, and we should still maintain it just as long as these girls are you know, the property of an older husband, I guess, presumably.
Yeah, he should do some thought experiments with JP, with Jordan Peterson. Yeah, he's a freak. But that was satisfying.
I mean, we need to see more of this from lawmakers and sort of hospital administrators, medical professionals, and people like that, because I don't think us on YouTube is going to be able to like turn it back when they're passing laws. Like North Dakota's already passing a law of banning gender stuff and including a type of like a tip line sort of system is to Texas.
Idaho's just making it a felony, any trans-affirming care for minors. But like that's why they have to continue bringing on guys like Matt Walsh, because they're running out of cranks and just kooks who have the credentials to be their fake medical experts, even though it's very, you know, differs from what the general consensus is. So they're bringing on like literal right-wing propaganda artists.
Should we go from one transphobe to another? Candace Owens?
Yeah, this clip's pretty disgusting, so I don't know.
Can we do the dog guy instead? I mean, I kind of have
which one is that?
Freaks. The Bradley, what number is that?
Yeah, this one's good. I can set it up if you want, Sam.
What number?
Number six.
No, wait, it's not six. Seven.
Seven.
Sorry. Number seven, Sam.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Okay. Yeah. This. Yeah. Do this one. Good.
Oh, do you want me to set it up?
Okay. Yeah. You set it up.
Yeah. So. Here's a Minnesota state representative, John Jasinski.
Senator, in fact.
Oh, I'm sorry, senator. He is here voicing his opposition to a marijuana legalization bill that they're discussing in committee. But the reasoning that he has for why this bill shouldn't pass is that some dogs might be unemployed.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
You know, the police dog discussion of all that and retraining, what's going to cost our local law enforcement agencies who've done these dogs, who've spent thousands and thousands of dollars on these dogs to get these dogs drug trained, and now they're going to have to be retired. That's a big issue. I was the mayor of Faribault and actually did a fundraising campaign to raise money to get a police dog, to have a drug dog, and now that money is going to go away because these dogs can't be used anymore, given that. So there's a huge cost there.
It's this. I mean, that's literally definitionally the sunk cost fallacy. Like, we paid for the dogs to do all the drug sniffing. So, I mean,
we got to keep it illegal.
Yeah. Right. I mean, what would they do without those dogs, without their sense of purpose? Right.
Well,
they would be unemployed. We have to work the dogs until they're dead. And I was joking on Twitter. It's like one of those stories you see about, you know, 86-year-old woman's a waitress still at Waffle House, you know, 24-year-old drug sniffing dogs. Still at it just because he needs to feed his family. That's that they want the capitalist system in the animal world too.
Well, that's why your 84-year-old a waitress, she can't quit because she bought she bought her own like little apron.
You're right.
To wear around. And like, what am I gonna do now? I got the apron. I gotta keep.
I like passing the law or like signing a check for like $2 million in drug sniffing dogs and then looking at the news and be like, oh crap.
Yeah.
Wait, Pot,
you know, the dogs could be redeployed to find stolen marijuana.
Honestly.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, this is also true of just cops themselves instead of just police dogs, right?
Yeah.
Like this is a large motivation of why we're maintaining this, a prohibition because like we need, you know, we have cops that want jobs.
They'll make the same argument about don't take my tanks away, or my heavily, I shouldn't say tanks, but like militarized vehicles, weaponry, all that kind of stuff. We already paid for this stuff, and there are toys.
All right, let's read some IMs, and we'll get out of here.
Sounds good.
Jazz Apple. Thanks, MR Crew, for lively and spot-on discussion yesterday regarding Taibbi and Greenwald's bullshit grift. I'm so frustrated with those two clowns. I'm happy you dished out some reality. I wish they'd come on the show for a spanking. Keep up the great work. Daredevil. Hey, I don't know if you're taking calls today, but I would love to call in and debate men's rights. 804 area code, regardless, love the show. Daredevil, thank you. We're not taking calls today. We'll have to do that in the future. Limecat had a great dream last night where I got to guard Elon Musk and he was able to continuously frustrate him with a smothering defense and fouls that were never called. Very satisfying to see his entitled face not get the favorable treatment he expects. 5 stars. Do recommend. Sorry, that last text was a basketball game. All out of bubblegum. Speaking of Tesla, on the M-Majority report yesterday, did you also catch Amazon's autonomous vehicles hitting public roads in San Francisco? That I mentioned they have no steering wheel or brake pedals and top speed of 75 miles an hour. Oh my God. Jesus.
Future, baby.
Maybe. Jibber Jabber. Isn't Hello Tushy technically a movement partner? Fair enough. Well
right.
done.
Right. Yeah.
Josh from St. Louis. Hope you'll ask Ryan Grimm about his excellent piece on the villages. Adam Matley. My immediate family is not super into politics, but I'm noticing they're surrounded by a community of conservatives that are casually introducing them to right-wing propagandists. Unfortunately, any time I try and point this out, my family takes it as a personal insult. Just looking for suggestions to push back without sending like a jerk know-it-all. You got to send them stuff, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how you operate with that.
Yeah,
Catskill
I mean, I
guess boy.
Try to meet their concerns and suggest your own media figures, I guess.
Pete also made some snarky comment on Twitter where he brushed off criticism by saying, now, if you'll excuse me, potholes need fixing. Stefan, someone who worked in the consulting industry before, most of the practices I saw were absolutely abhorrent and disconnected from human experience. Mm. The only thing that matters to them is how much they can bill. That's it. Had to quit for my mental health after a year. Yeah, I really do think that like incompetence and just pure greed explains a lot.
They make so much money. So consultants, like, you know, I just anecdotally, I've had friends that have got, I don't actually have any friends, but people I know that literally went in because it's like, you make so, so much money right out of college.
I still remember my freshman intro to comm theory class. This was right before the sort of financial crisis completely, like, I think it sort of like dawned on everyone how significant it was going to be. And he said, if you want to make big money with this degree, go into consulting.
Mm-hmm.
Looking forward, bingo dango, to Matt Taibbi's The Fox News Files Twitter thread about all these juicy documents that expose a clear conspiracy on the part of Fox News to try and influence election results. Burst out laughing. Fun fact, that door quote, to find out who rules, you see who you can't criticize, is a quote from a literal Nazi referring to Jews in Weimar Germany.
Jesus.
Not a surprise to me.
Day Glow Lefty. Sam, if you somehow get to debate Jordan Peterson, you should do it in your Hugo voice. That would actually be really funny. That would actually be really funny. Pim Tool. Yes, big hell on earth listener here, Matt Chrisman. Tell the MR crew about Arch buses. Teach those dogs how to play fetch. All right, five more. Show Far Away. Per the 26-minute call on Wednesday, that men's right movement has had 3 decades to figure out what they want, and they still can't explain it. It's like nailing Jell-O to a wall.
What they want is a therapist.
Gerald from New Orleans. At one point, Jimmy Dore tweeted that he got long COVID from the vax, in case you were wondering if there was a bottom to his grift. Our dog. Hey, Sam and crew, yesterday on the H3 podcast, Ethan Klein and Hassan Piker both said they want to get you on the show. The day before that, Ethan said he loves you and wants to promote your show. H3 has a huge audience. How can we get Sam, oh no, what an effing nightmare, to their studio in L.A.? I would love to go on their show. I have no plans in the short term to go to L.A., but, you know, could always happen.
I'm going to be there in May.
I'm a fan of both of them. You're going to be there in May?
Right. For my best friend's bachelorette, remember, but I'm going to stay behind a little and see see some TYT folks, so that actually could work.
Iowa Ryan, Sam, could I have sued the restaurant that fired me for asking someone to put on a mask? It was before the vaccine. I have so much anger of what I went through. This restaurant would fill up every day. I would hear Joe Rogan, Jimmy Dore anti-mask bullshit every day. I never got over it. Mm. I raised 2 stepkids waiting tables. Now I do something completely different for a living. It really messed up my life. You know what? Might be worth calling a local labor law lawyer. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that. Between 9 and 91 and Route 5, being a highly paid public employee is evidence of being in a conspiracy. Somebody needs to tell Jimmy about college football coaches. You know who your most highest paid worker in any given city is? It's the cops.
Mm. Jimmy Dore might know something about that.
Chicago letter carrier. Jimmy Nordob only gets prescriptions from his doctor, Jack Daniels.
Jesus. Jack Daniels, MD.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
It's crazy.
2 more. Spocko. I really like the way that Ryan Grimm talked about the definition of malice. Remember when Tucker Carlson put up the photos of Vanderbilt medical executives and lied about their transgender care for minors? Be good to read the text messages of Tucker and his producers, but they probably learned from the Dominion case and there's no text messages now. I'd love to see the multi-billion-dollar defamation cases made for Boston Children's Hospital and others. I indeed. And the final I am of the week. Let's do this. Emma Rohde, NYC. Emma telling a men's rights activist that he's acting hysterical while he was, in fact, being hysterical had to be the best on the internet this week, hands down.
That was good. Yeah, you know, I realized that when he was calling in saying he was a liberal, he was probably trolling, right? Like trying.
I think he's very confused. Like, yeah. I don't know if he's in control of himself.
Maybe that's right. Know. He is over emotional.
I mean, he wanted to talk about MAGA Latinos, and that was a fever dream that we were.
Yeah,
part of.
Right.
folks, Al Knipchen, read my IM, please, please. I just did. Bradley, Matt, Emma, great job this week. See you guys. Oh, I'm out for a week.
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. That's school
vacation. Wow. Well, you'll be in good hands.
Yes.
That's Have right. fun next week, guys.
We will.
See you in a week.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know.